On the midway between Minneapolis and St. Paul, my name is Ian Punnett. I've packed my pipe and I've got a cup of tea ready to go and some news to get to right out of the box that pertains to the last couple of weeks of shows. And we may be making a little news here, too, coming up this hour on Coast to Coast AM. Our guest, Glenn Kimball, next hour, is a direct result from an emailer from a couple of weeks ago who wanted to know more about whatever happened to that dig that Glenn and I had been talking about for a couple of years on Coast to Coast, the pursuit of ancient Egyptian artifacts from an underground cavern in southern Illinois. A site that had been largely kept secret, but yet also had become sort of increasingly active up to about 2001. And we never did hear the rest of the story, or at least I didn't. And so Glenn has agreed to come on and talk about that and all of the new research into ancient manuscripts and to sort of the lost movements of the world that often came through unusual places such as that that River Delta area of southern Illinois from the ancient Egyptians. We'll talk about that with Glenn Kimball. Also, we'll get a special update here in just a minute I'll tell you about. But I don't know if you saw the front page of the New York Times today. Front page of the New York Times. Below the fold, but still front page. A story which I can't quite figure out because it seems to be talking about last week's show, in a way, on Coast to Coast. It's all about Planet X. And they talk about whether or not it's a planet or not. Pluto now has a far-out rival. Add a 10th planet or take one away. They don't know. And it seems to have absolutely no news in it. I went through this story. I couldn't find one piece of information that wasn't something that we had already talked about last week with Jason Martel. And yet there were many things that we talked about with Jason which don't pop up in this story. Maybe if somebody knows more about it, they can let me know. At space.com, the announcement that came through earlier this week is still fascinating me, that the sun has a twin. Maybe you heard the solar doppelganger, as they call it, at space.com, hits nearly identical marks in temperature, rotation, and age. Planet hunters have it on their list, but there's no word yet on whether carbon-based folks are looking back at their star's twin, which would be our own sun. It's called 18 Scorpii, and it sits about 47.5 light years away in the constellation Scorpio. So if you know your Latin, Scorpii being of Scorpio. And just like twins I know, Charlie and Sam, one who's a little better at art and the other's a little better at sports, so too it is with 18 Scorpii and our sun. 18 Scorpii burns slightly hotter than the sun, and it also appears to rotate slightly faster than the sun and is just a bit younger than our sun. Man admits role in the failed London attack. This update from just hours ago. According to the Associated Press, a suspect in the failed London transit bombings admitted to a role in the attack, but said it was only intended to be an attention-grabbing terror strike, not a deadly one. This goes back to conversations we were having with Howard Bloom in a strong way. Osman Hussein told interrogators he wasn't carrying enough explosives even to, quote, harm people nearby. He is one of four suspected bombers in the July 21st attacks in London. He was grilled by a pair of Italy's top anti-terrorism prosecutors. Hussein said that months ago in London, his chief in a cell group, which he says is not related to Al-Qaeda, taught him to assemble explosives. That guy's name is Mukhtar Saeed Ibrahim. One of the other people that police captured on Friday, he urged us to be careful, apparently Hussein told investigators. He didn't want to kill, just sow terror. We didn't want to kill, just sow terror. This is the basis on which he's fighting extradition to Britain. His attorney said he doesn't consider himself a terrorist. He just wanted to sow terror, but he doesn't consider himself to be a terrorist. Townhall.com has this strange story that you might have heard about as an internet rumor, which turns out to be true, at least it's been thus far confirmed, Battle Staff Directive number 41 is not a fake. Maybe you heard about this. It was categorized as for official use only, and it was issued at Hill Air Force Base in Utah last week to raise a red flag about an incident at Tinker Air Force Base on July 14th of this year. Three individuals observed outside the perimeter of Tinker Air Force Base in Oklahoma. They were looking through binoculars, taking pictures, and one appeared to be holding a large weapon at chest level. The weapon appeared to be aimed towards a low-flying aircraft. The three individuals were described as being of Middle Eastern descent and left the area when approached. The weapon was later identified as a rocket launcher, a man pad, is what it says here in parentheses, and the low-flying aircraft to be a B-1 bomber. FBI in Oklahoma City and Air Force Office of Special Investigations determined the threat to be credible. More information on this, too, at the website that they have for Soldiers for the Truth. The threat of an Al-Qaeda attack using shoulder-fired anti-aircraft missiles has been of increasing concern to Homeland Security officials. Last year, the FBI arrested two imams in Albany in connection with a sting operation involving laundered funds that the defendants were led to believe were proceeds from the sale of a missile launcher to be issued in a New York City terrorist plot. That effort failed, but as it says here, the terrorists will no doubt try again. Meanwhile, Washington has been squabbling over whether and how much money to spend on retrofitting all 6,000 planes in the American commercial fleet with electronic countermeasures to combat the threat. We all know somehow when the funding for that will magically appear. It's usually just after a tragedy. This is a tragedy. It's just a really weird story out of New York. Unless there's an update, this is still valid. A 13-year-old boy from Stamford, Connecticut, missing Saturday afternoon after he disappeared from a men's room on a Friday night trip to Yankee Stadium. Hundreds of police and security guards failed to find Majalik Lewis after he disappeared to a trip to the bathroom during the seventh inning stretch of the Yankees-Angels game. His mother had immediately reported him missing to security, who then brought in police about an hour later. They searched the entire stadium, parking lots, restricted areas, locked rooms, fruitless. Officers also searched nearby fast food restaurants, train stations. The search didn't end until almost 6 o'clock in the morning. Every stadium exit is monitored by security cameras, and the boy's mother did not spot him on hours of recorded images. He has no behavioral or mental problems, no history of running away. He's an average kid, said his father. Between 10 and 15 children are reported missing at every Yankees game, but almost are immediately located. This kid, just poof, so far, gone. And Senator Sam Brownback has introduced the Human Chimera Prohibition Act of 2005. Some people say chimera. The bill would prohibit any person from creating or attempting to create a human-animal hybrid. Of course, it's broadly defined as including various methods of mixing non-human cells into human embryos. There is actually no sponsor of the bill, but it is in the middle of the Senate Judiciary Committee as we speak. And perhaps you saw CBS reported on it. There is a headline out. Makers of aspartame tell a whopper. And we will give you the latest on the research, which seems to indicate more faked results for aspartame. Next, with Dr. Betty Martini on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Dr. Betty Martini has spent decades in the medical fields, including research and advocacy. She's the founder of the Global Volunteer Force Mission Impossible International, which educates the public on aspartame and warns of the dangers. We'll give you website information here in just a minute. But let me just say thank you, Dr. Martini, for agreeing to come on and giving us the latest on this.
Oh, thank you. I'm so glad to be on your show.
Thank you. We got the email that came in from somebody, and the headline was about how the makers of aspartame tell a whopper. And I know that some people may have heard about this already, but just take it from the top for us on the new research involving aspartame and cancer.
Well, that was a study done in Italy just recently. And it's a three-year study, and as Dr. Blaylock said, who is a neurosurgeon, he says this confirms the previous study by Dr. Crocco and co-workers, which also found the formaldehyde breakdown product of aspartame to be damaging to cellular DNA, and that this damage was cumulative. And what it caused was leukemia, lymphoma, and malignant brain tumors. And he said, this means that drinking a single Diet Cola sweetened with aspartame every day could increase one's risk of developing this. And, of course, we've known as far about the malignant brain tumors all the way back from the beginning, because that was the reason that the FDA wanted the original manufacturer indicted. They were doing things like taking the tumors, excising them from the rats, putting the rats back in the study, and then when the rats died, they'd resurrect them on paper. Unfortunately, both U.S. prosecutors hired on with the defense team, and the statute of limitations expired. But all this information is a matter of public record, so we've been seeing this great increase in malignant brain tumors, and Dr. John Oney in 1996 made world news about the association. So this is just confirming what we've already known.
What's the whopper of it? Just that it confirms the fact that some of these studies have been faked before, or is there something else that they have said recently in an attempt to try to dissuade people from believing this?
Well, they rebutted it. They came back. The reason I said that, I said, here comes the whopper, is they said that no studies have ever shown that aspartame can cause cancer, and that's not true. First of all, in the beginning, it's in the Breslau report, the audit by the FDA, is that when something was malignant, for instance, in rats, they would filter it out so that the FDA would not see it. But then Dr. Adrian Gross, who was the FDA toxicologist, told Congress that aspartame violated the Delaney Amendment, which forbid putting anything in food that you knew absolutely would cause cancer. And if the, quote, if the FDA violated its own law, who was left to protect the public? And he was talking about the fact that it absolutely could cause brain cancer. And then Searle, who was the original manufacturer, did studies on humans in six countries, and we do have an affidavit from the translator, where they gave people in poor villages aspartame, and they developed brain tumors and seizures. It showed that it destroyed the brain. It showed that it destroyed the central nervous system, and also harden the synovial fluids, which is why most aspartame victims have so much joint pain. But it has been shown then in humans and in animals, and the increase in brain tumors just keeps going up, so that now we are taking case histories for litigation on brain tumors in New York, New Jersey, Mississippi, and Madison County, Illinois, because it's been proven beyond a shadow of a doubt.
Are there any countries that have banned it?
There was at a time that, you know, they used to have a saying in Italy, if you want to get embalmed, come to America. But eventually, the reason that all the countries, it's in 100 countries of the world at least, is because of the pop companies. You know, they've got aspartame in diet pop. So that put it through all the countries. And this is what's so bad about the product, is that it liberates free methyl alcohol, and it causes chronic methanol poisoning. That affects the dopamine system of the brain and causes addiction. Methanol is classified as narcotic.
And what about Splenda? I mean, I use that as often as I can.
Well, please don't.
Really? What's wrong with that?
It's a chlorocarbon poison. It's got chlorine in it. We call it DDT light. And the reason we're getting so many reactions to it is people, you know, they're getting the word out about aspartame. They know it's a neurotoxin. So they think they'll switch over to Splenda. But aspartame is a chemical hypersensitization agent. It causes polychemical sensitivity syndrome. That's the same thing as MCS. So it not only reacts to all drugs, but it reacts to other toxins or unsafe sweeteners. So they get off of aspartame, they get on Splenda, and one of the doctors, Dr. Bowen, says now they'll keep the aspartame symptoms, plus they'll get the ones on Splenda. Dr. Mercola is the doctor who has one of these big sites that's written so many articles against Splenda, and we have one article called The Lethal Science of Splenda, explaining how it's made, which is on WNHO.net.
And I thought it was just sugar. I thought it was just a variation of sugar.
No, they just started with that, and that's why Marisan has sued the makers of Splenda for saying, you know, it's natural, which of course it's not. And of course, this is the kettle calling the pot black, because this is what happened in there were three congressional hearings on aspartame, and they got onto them because they were advertising this is something natural, like mother's milk, when it's toxic chemicals. It's made out of aspartic acid, which is an excitotoxin, which is a product that literally stimulates the neurons of the brain to death, methyl alcohol, a neurotoxin, and 50% phenylalanine, which as an isolate is neurotoxic, lowers the seizure threshold and depletes serotonin. That's why the kids have all these behavioral problems and psychiatric problems. When you deplete serotonin, you get bipolar and mood swings and all of this type of thing. And then it breaks down to diketokiprazine, which is the brain tumor agent, which gave brain tumors to rats in original studies.
Now, okay, am I back to saccharin then?
Well,
tell me how I can do saccharin.
Well, actually, you can. It's a coal tar product, but it's been on the market for over 100 years with just a few symptoms. But I wouldn't put it in my mouth, because there are things like stevia, which you can get from a health food store, which helps in the metabolism of sugar. I know that the Stevita Company in Dallas says that they have 500 studies showing safety. It's perfect for diabetics. And then someone sent me something called Just Like Sugar, which is made out of four products, chicory and orange peel and calcium and something else. And they're doing an analysis for us to show that there's no MSG and,
right,
and nothing bad in it. So because
so Just Like Sugar?
It's called that Just Like Sugar, and they have a website.
Okay, so far, at least, you know, initially you'll go with that one.
Yes, and I know that a lot of people now are using things like xylitol, which you can get from a health food store. Which
that doesn't sound like a health food product.
Well, actually, it's sort of a sugar alcohol, but the only problem, it does cause bloating and cramps, according to Dr. Blaylock. But if you use a little bit, it's not so bad. They have that xylitol gum, and Wrigley's has just about put aspartame in all of their products. It is one of the worst products, because Dr. H.J. Roberts, who declared aspartame disease to be a plague, says it's buccal. So it works like nitroglycerin under the tongue, goes through saliva straight to the brain. So people have to be warned about gum using it. So that's the only can so far we found, is that xylitol gum, which is not dangerous, but it does, if you use too much, you can get some bloating from it.
Okay, and so to recap, the story is that Italian researchers have reconfirmed previous studies on the link between aspartame and cancer, and that the manufacturers of aspartame are in sort of corporate spin mode, and they're saying that this is an invalid study?
Well, they're trying to say that it doesn't go along with their research in the past. Now, that's particularly interesting because on 60 Minutes, Dr. Ralph Walton, who's a psychiatrist, did some research on scientific peer-reviewed studies and funding. And 92% of all independent studies showed the problems with aspartame. And he says if you remove six studies from the FDA, 100% of scientific peer-reviewed studies show the problems. Only the ones funded by the manufacturer and controlled by the manufacturer have ever said aspartame was safe.
Dr. Betty Martini, thank you so much for the update. If you want to find out more, what website would you recommend them to go to? You're on a bunch.
www.wnho.net. And if you want the government, a lot of the government records, it's
got to be quick.
Doorway.com.
Doorway.com.
O-R-10-in-the-door.com.
Thank you, Dr. Martini. Coast to Coast AM. Email next. I'm Ian Punnett. So we'll do open phones for the rest of this hour, and then Glenn Kimball coming up next hour. Looking forward to chatting with Glenn. It's been way too long. And many of you wrote and said, what happened to all of that research into these Egyptian forays into central United States, into the territory of the Mississippi Delta? What happened? And what did they ever find at the bottom of those shafts? And we'll talk about that coming up with Glenn here in just a few minutes, and find out, too, whether he's got any new projects on the way on Coast to Coast AM next hour. Looking forward to where you're going to take us to. Lots of people emailing about the Giants from last week, and many of you sending me the links to Stephen Quayle. I'm looking forward to talking to him sometime in the future. Brian wrote to say that he said the Giants were a hybrid race of humans, and it's worthy of investigation, worthy of consideration, too, whether or not, in light of the news story we read earlier in the hour, attempting to block any hybrid humans, you know, any human and non-human cells, whether that would ever block that type of race again, if such a thing existed. And, you know, it really makes you wonder, too, about Congress here, is if they keep us from, you know, mixing human cells with, say, like chimp cells, how would we ever come up with future Congress people? I ask you. Brian also says there's a very easy way to light up a pyramid. We were talking about this with Jason Martell last week about the Baghdad battery. He said you do not need any form of future technology or supernatural power. All you need is to set up a series of mirrors to reflect sunlight down a shaft and around corners. Please comment on that. I will. And you're right. My comment is, duh. I should have thought about that. Leo and Suze wrote about Jason Martell's use of the word sexadecimal in terms of a base six. And he said that the older term, the pure Latin sexadecimal, is no longer used in favor of hexadecimal for a computer-based language. It was changed because people thought sexadecimal, according to the Art History Online reference and guide, that sexadecimal was thought by people to be too risque. In a million years, I never would have thought of sex with an underage numeral by hearing sexadecimal. James writes to say, I don't trust a man who drinks tea. You know what? If it's any consolation to you, James, this tea is terrible, and I'm barely drinking it. So maybe for tonight, you can barely trust me. Reichen wrote, 4 years ago, we took over 3,000 photos of the true Stargate that is still present and safe in the now Iraq. It is located below Lake Tharthar, he says. It is still in pristine condition, hasn't been corrupted by either modern Iraqi governments or Western governments. He doesn't say who the we is or how it is that he should come across this. He says, we used a unique remote viewing photographic process that allowed us to both locate and photograph the Stargate, both in its present state and in usage in ancient times. Photos of this amazing chamber and what it contains will eventually be posted at our website, Riken. Eventually, please let me know when you've got those posted. We'd love to take a look at them. Joshua says, I like your sense of humor. How long have you been on the radio? About 40 minutes. Thank you, Joshua. No, actually, about 30 years and 40 minutes. Just curious, because if you don't mind me asking, what exactly are you packing in those pipes? There's a good chance you aren't smoking pipe tobacco, but I could be wrong. Actually, it is just pipe tobacco. It's peach tobacco from a tobacco shop called Ye Olde Tobacco Shop in Savannah, Georgia, where I was just hanging out. However, Joshua, my tea is made from hashish. Maybe that's why. No, I'm just kidding. But this couldn't be worse. And finally, this one from Tim. Dear Ian, I hate you. I hope that a herd of rabid wild water buffalo stomp on your pipe and ravenous sea otters drink all your tea. Signed, Tim. Thank you, Tim. Ravenous sea otter spit could only make this tea taste better at this point. We'll come back. Where are you going to take us? Open phones till the top of the hour on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. By the way, if you haven't heard it yet, that Perfect Possession compact disc that comes with your new subscription for After Dark is really awesome. I was just listening to it, driving it around the other day. 1-888-727-5505. I had email about our first caller west of the Rockies last week, because both of how the conversation started and how it ended. So I'm so glad he's calling back. Suleiman, are you there?
I'm here. How are you doing, Ian, this evening?
Okay, I'm doing so well. As you know, you were just about to say something going into the top of the hour last week, and then the weirdest thing happened, and we don't know how, right as you were just about to give us, a prediction? Is that what you were building up to?
Yeah, that's correct.
Suddenly, it was like the phone switched, like something happened, like a circuit jumped or something, and we were hearing somebody else going, hello, hello, hello. So we were all kind of left hanging there a little bit. So it's better that you're the first caller west of the Rockies, because I actually had people email and say, all right, what was the rest of that? And I couldn't tell them, and I couldn't tell why it ended. So go ahead, let's take it from the top, and now we've got a little time.
Matt, first I'd like to compliment your screener. She's very, very sharp, very compassionate and nice. And in regards to, the callers that are the individuals that email that negativity to you.
Oh, no, don't worry about that.
Okay, let me tell you, you've got fans all over the planet, and I'm one of them.
Oh, thank you. You're sweet. I get a kick out of that. Nikki, by the way, Nikki's doing the phones, and she does a terrific job. And thank you, too, to David for running the board. And here I should mention both Ethan and Tony, who have been running it on our end over here.
Okay.
So, Ian, we were just getting to some really interesting part.
Exactly. There are several different predictions that I'm going to run through, and hopefully in the future, if time permits on one of these evenings that you're on, I definitely would like to come on as a guest, because I have a plethora of information to disseminate to your very intelligent audience.
Okay.
I've initiated on the website called Grassy Knoll, GrassyKnoll.com. Those that are listening to the show right now, they can go to that website and they could see 5 or 6 pages in regards to predictions that I have made, and some are very frightening. I have a warning that I want to initiate to those in California. I've had a very distinct vision that when the conflagration starts with the United States and North Korea, when the United States actually attacks the 3 nuclear facilities there, North Korea has the capability of attacking with nuclear weapons. I saw Tokyo being struck, and I saw Los Angeles being struck with a black missile between 7 and 8 a.m. in the morning, a very, very bright, sunny day in California. And when the explosion occurred over the city, an area 50 miles in radius was devastated, and out of the center of that explosion, the magma of the earth shot up several thousand feet, and it was very, very clear that this particular situation can occur. I am so confident that this situation might happen. I contacted the Pentagon, the Joint Chief of Staff, about a month ago, and I detailed the same information, and I asked them if they would put Patriot missiles along the coast of Southern California from Palos Verdes to Orange County. I also called Senator Boxer and Senator Feinstein, and I delivered the same message. So I want your listeners to know that people have been contacted in regards to this particular vision.
All right. Also, and any idea on a time frame on this?
If, in fact, mankind can get through 2005, the next few months in 2005, mankind will have the potential of healing itself. But in the from August forward, we are going through some very, very destructive times on the planet. And all of this can occur in, very, very shortly. For instance, the Middle East, be aware that the invasion of Syria and Iran is imminent. I have a friend who calls both the Art Bell Show and George Nuri Show, and is also going to be calling your show. He's told me in the last month there have been massive fighters and bombers and cargo planes leaving from the East Coast going into the Middle East. And none of the news media has been mentioning these particular stories. Also on Guam, there has been a buildup of stealth fighters and bombers for this North Korean scenario. Now, I saw this nuclear conflagration in the Middle East. I saw how it occurred. I saw an attack, conventional attack on Israel, after Iran and Syria were attacked by U.S. forces. I saw Israel using nuclear weapons. I saw other countries getting involved using nuclear weapons, along with Russia and China. And there was a weapon, Eon, that was used that detonated the ionosphere. Right now, there are billions and billions of atomic particles circumventing the Earth from all the weapons that had been detonated from the 1940s. And when this weapon I saw detonate in the ionosphere, it created a curtain of fire that stretched from horizon to horizon. It went up at least a couple of miles, and then it fell to the surface of the Earth, and it rushed forward and backwards, and I saw the entire Middle East engulfed in a flaming fire, just as they said in Armageddon.
All right. Well, I tell you what, that's about as much as I can process at this point. So I will confess to having a lot there to mull over. I'm sure other people will. I look forward to hearing from you in the future. And anybody, if you want to, you can link up to us at the website at coasttocoastam.com. And thank you, Solomon, for getting back with us so we could find out just what you were seeing. And I look forward to you. You all understand, I look forward to you being wrong. You know that. I mean, I don't want you to be right. So, but I look forward to hearing from you in the future. So thank you and God bless you. Have a great night. Let's go to the wild card line where Dave is in Vermont. We've got open phones here for the next few minutes. Hey, Dave.
My name's Rick.
All right. Well, they have you down as Dave, but I'll take you as Rick.
I'll take Dave, anything. I've been trying for 9 years to get through to Coast to Coast.
Well, I'm glad you made it tonight.
And I am. Bear with me for a couple minutes. I'm retired out of the Navy, but I've got two different stories I've been trying to tell for 9 years. The first one started about 72 or 73. I was in McCall on Payette Lake in a boat with my father and another man. We were idle, and in the horizon, a silver cylinder flew overhead fairly low, really fast, but, I mean, it was all the way across the lake. Everyone in town saw it. People at the store saw it. My mother was at the grocery store. She saw it. Now, 1989, 1989. I was stationed in Fallon, Nevada. I worked at the military police. We had a bombing range about 50, 60 miles east of town, high-tech thing with a bunch of electronic stuff, where we had two patrol people that had to go one station, the other one made patrols, and this was a 24, 7-day-a-week kind of thing. It's late at night, about 3 in the morning, I get a phone call. My dispatcher does, and he says, hey, you need to take this. It's a woman down at the front gate of the Hawthorne bombing or ammo storage place, small little place. She's at the front gate. She wants to know if we're flying any planes. I say, no. She goes, she's looking at two things hovering over Walker Lake. She said they're approximately 50 to 100 feet off the ground of off the lake. And I said, are you looking at them? She said, I'm looking right at them. She said, they're about the length of a football field each, and they're hovering over the lake. We then get a phone call. He gets on another line from a deputy sheriff down there that says he's looking at this thing flying, and he's saying, are we flying? We said, no, maybe it was Nellis Air Force Base. He said, son, I've done 26 years in the Air Force. We've seen nothing. All of a sudden, about 8-10 minutes later, we get a phone call from the guys out at this main station where all this electronic gear is, the kind of the head central thing. All the alarms, all the lights are just going. I mean, it just sounds like mass chaos as all these alarms are going off. They said the whole thing lit up for about 45 seconds, every light, everything there, and then it just shut down, and all it was black and all these alarms going off.
Hmm. Yeah.
My dispatcher and I said, how are we going to log this one? I said, well, let's take the first one. The alarm's going off, unknown reason, because I didn't know how to begin to explain that.
Yeah, how do you ever try to encapsulate that in a log? Usually those log entries are like two lines, aren't they?
Yeah, well, it's just kind of like, you know, it was like, well, we had nothing but rumor phone calls, and the only thing we could substantiate was the alarms did go off from some unknown reason.
Well, Rick, Dave, I'm glad you got through.
Man,
sorry it took you 9 years to do it.
I've been trying to get this off my chest. If anybody out there is listening and can remember the thing flying over Payette Lake in McCall or something that was flying around 88, springtime, in Walker Lake, around that area, I sure would love somebody else, because I ran into my dispatcher one day, and we had a beer, and he said, you know, I've been dying to get this off my chest.
I bet.
Well, all right. Ian, I appreciate it. It's good talking to you.
And to
George,
you.
George, I wish I got a hold of you and Art, too.
Well, maybe the follow-up will come with Art or George. So when they're doing open lines, don't be surprised if somebody picks up the ball then and runs with it, or that if you poke around a little bit around the web, you might be able to find a site where you can continue that chat going and keep the word out there. And thanks for getting through with me. Richard, east of the Rockies, in the time that we have left on Coast to Coast AM. Richard?
Ian.
Where are you going to take us?
I'm thrilled you're back on the air.
Oh, thank you.
This question is coming from a book called The Seat of the Soul by Gary Zukav.
Sure.
And it has to do with the cycles within cycles, like the moon circling the earth, circling the sun, and how long they all take.
Mm-hmm.
And one is a 2,000-year cycle, one is a 5,000-year cycle, and one is a 125,000-year cycle that are all coming to a grand conclusion very soon. And I was wondering, it has to do with releasing patterns of negative energy and fear, and whatever's going on right now seems, you know, pretty horrible. So it's all going to be a conclusion, and it's going to be something new. And I was wondering, what is the 125,000-year cycle, the 25,000-year cycle, and the 2,000-year cycle?
I've got Gary Zukav's book at home, and I have read probably only the first two or three chapters from it. Somebody gave it to me a couple of years ago, and I was really enjoying it, but as so often happens, somebody else gives me another book, and then I really enjoy that too, and I don't often get back to them. I'll go look that up. And he might make an interesting guest, as you point out, as we're going through these cycles here on Earth. We do sort of see a pattern in our timing, and maybe there is something that kind of correlates with other things that we're reading about in the news.
Mm-hmm.
What do you see in it?
You know, I'm not. I want to know what the whole. Well, you know what I thought it was because of another guest. This is on page 204. Just so when you get home, you can look it up. It's after page 200. Somebody was talking about the golden age is going to begin in the year 2012, And you know how long it takes some of these planets and comets and whatever to get back around the sun and pass by us?
Right.
I was just thinking maybe it has to do with 2012, but maybe not. I would like to know if you can find it and look into it.
Yeah, I will. And I wonder whether any of this ties into all these discussions people having are about Planet X,
mm-hmm.
too, for that matter, or this discovery of the twin sun, the sun's twin, which is just, I found riveting at space.com. Well, these are the kinds of things which we will consider on Coast to Coast AM at any time. And we always try to bring you updates when we have them. Sometimes we have to dig, if you pardon the expression, a little bit for them. And in this case, it's just what we did with Glenn Kimball. It'll be so much fun to have him back on. He's always interesting. And I have been so curious whatever happened with Glenn Kimball's project in southern Illinois related to ancient Egyptian artifacts and whatever else Glenn Kimball is up to. We'll find out coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Well, those of you who have been listening to Coast AM for a long time already know much of the work of Glenn Kimball. Always interesting, always entertaining. I'm sure that this show will be no different. And Glenn's big interests are many, but he has always been focused in one way or another to both ancient manuscripts, ergo his website, ancientmanuscripts.com, and also ancient Americans. That is to say, the story of Americans' prehistory, and for that matter, ancient American tourists, people who have come through and spent time for whatever reason and for whatever purpose in the Americas, and what they left behind, or in some cases, as in the in the story of a Scottish church that has images of cactuses or cacti from America in a church 100 years before Columbus even sailed, is that we're also interested in what these ancient American tourists took back or dropped off. And where we left off a couple years ago with Glenn Kimball was the dig going on in southern Illinois. We have the long-awaited update, and perhaps even the southern Illinois Rosetta Stone, so to speak, of ancient Egyptian tourists coming to the United States. So more on the latest research into ancient manuscripts and ancient Americans next with Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Well, this is as much fun for me professionally as it is personally to talk with Glenn Kimball again. Hey, Glenn, you old son of a gun, how you doing?
My goodness, what a joy to speak with you again, Ian. You and I have been friends for a long time.
I'm going to be giggling for about a half hour just because it's so exciting for me to talk to you.
It's ecstatic for me, too.
Is your family well and everything good?
Yeah, I got married in the meantime between...
Get out!
I married just a wonderful lady. I swore on a stack of Bibles that I would never marry again. And the moment you do that, you know what the Almighty does to you, you know.
And that despite your graying mustache on your website?
I'm not so much concerned about the gray as the increasing shadow. and the magnetic force that I seem to be creating as I walk down the street with this immense mass.
Well, mazel tov on her, and glad to know that your life is still interesting and robust and full of new projects like this Bee Bible, which I'll ask you about later on.
Mm-hmm.
And I also want to ask you, are you still involved with Ancient American Magazine?
Absolutely. Wayne and I speak all the time, and, you know, with my new venture in Mexico, I've been asked to do some research for a large investment group that's doing actually building a brand new city down there. And they are actually creating a city where none had ever stood before. And they asked me to name the town and to help create the museum and the artifacts that will be there for the tourist attraction. And then what's most important is to sit on the board of the broadcast studios down there and be able to create content from that studio. It's the closest point from Phoenix to the ocean that there is, so it's going to be wonderful.
Well, I want to find out more about your Mexican project, too, later on, but let's start with where we last left off. And for people who don't know, let's start from the top, though, a little bit about what got you interested in what the early research was into expeditions into southern Illinois from ancient mariners.
Well, obviously, last year, since we last talked, too, I've been to Egypt, and I was a guest of the absolutely spectacular Princess Malik, who was the former queen of, before her husband died, of Morocco. She's the one that owns the King Tut exhibit. She invited me to Egypt, and we took a trip on her barge up the Nile, and she took me on a personal guided tour of Karnak, what was amazing to me, she's just such an amazing person, is that she had such a connection with the Western world in terms of she had two near-death experiences that she talked to me privately about. And she met the same person I did in her near-death experience and swore, even though she's Islamic, swore that to her dying day that she would increase the knowledge of the great one who needs no name tag. In Egypt, we were able to find, obviously, some of the stories of the thing that impressed me as I was in Karnak with the princess taking her personal guided tour right into the temple itself was how much these people worshipped boats. And I found out that there was a great difference between Upper Egypt and Lower Egypt, and the reason why they were separated, they were two separate cultures. The culture of Upper Egypt looked to the east as their homeland, which sank under the ocean in a cataclysmic explosion, and they called themselves the Red Men, just like our Native American Indians called themselves Red Men. Lower Egypt looked to the west as the ancestral homeland of their people, and they claimed that their homeland sank under the ocean some before Menes, who was the one who was supposedly built the temple on the Giza Plateau. And so we're talking about people looking to the east and to the west, and ultimately where they were looking is a place called the Ultima Thule, which is the ultimate divide. This ultimate divide is located in India and Indonesia, where this land sank into the winy Red Sea. And it sank at the time of the explosion of Krakatoa in 11,600 years ago. But these people talked about four previous civilizations of humans on the planet that had been destroyed because of cataclysms that had happened. And the cataclysms had come because they had fallen out of favor with the teachings of their gods, so to speak, in much the same way, perhaps, as what happened at the time of Noah. But these men were men that lived a very, very long time and lived in a paradise. They called it paradise. They called it Eden or Eden. Amazingly, before Adam and Eve came into this Garden of Eden. And by the way, remember that Adam and his progenitors lived a very long time there until the time of the flood, which is the same lifespans of the people who were talked about from Egypt. This is no coincidence. This whole story has been tied in. What has happened since the final patriarchs, Adam and Eve, came into the world, in our Western Christian philosophies, this same scenario has existed over and over and over again. And I found it fascinating. But in essence, we have found in recent days in Illinois, now this is quite surprising, another stone. I sent you a picture of it. It's It looks exactly like an Egyptian sarcophagus. It is very, very old. We haven't had it dated yet. We haven't had it in our possession that long to be able to have it dated. We're looking at maybe hiring one of the groups that did the analysis. There were three groups that did the analysis on the Shroud of Turin, and one of their groups is here in Arizona, at least some of the members that were in that body, to take a look at this stone to try and give us a date. But on this stone, which was found in a burial mound in Illinois, very near the cave, are pristine Egyptian hieroglyphs that can be read.
Well, now, I want to stop there because I think we're still missing a piece for people who don't know the narrative thread of this. But the belief is that somewhere between those origins of which you speak, we have travelers coming into America, going up through the Mississippi, and then burying treasure, or what we would think of as treasure, in these mounds in southern Illinois.
And there are some 10,000 burial mounds in the Mississippi Valley. They're still there today. There's enormous archaeology that needs to be completed. To give you some sort of reference for your audience, one of the oldest documents in the world is the Book of Adam and Eve, written in Aramaic and found in Egypt, by the way, preserved by the Coptics, and we have good copies of it in English in our day. Adam and Eve exited this Garden of Eden in the West Gate. Now, most of the people talk about Cain, etc., leaving and to the east and going to the land of Nod. But the West Gate is kind of curious, because where is the West Gate? We've lost track of that in our biblical scenarios. The West Gate, when Adam and Eve left, they left to a place where there were caves, and these caves were caves of treasures. These were obviously places that had been occupied long before Adam and Eve came into the world, and people had buried their treasures, their archaeology. They had lived in these caves. They had worshipped in temples in these places. And it is my presumption and my thoughts, after having studied a variety of different manuscripts, that we might very well be talking about the Mississippi Valley. Because if you look at the where the traditional historians place the Garden of Eden in Iraq, I don't care where you go in Iraq, you don't find anything that looks remotely like a paradisal garden that with trees that didn't need cultivation, except along the very banks of the Tigris and Euphrates and the other four rivers that are there. Very, very, it's not a lush garden. This is a sterile place to live, and has been for some 30 to 50,000 years. And it certainly has not been a lush garden since the end of the Pleistocene era in 11,600 years ago, the end of the last ice age. So we're talking about Adam and Eve living in some place that does not match up with what traditional historians think of in terms of the Eden or Eden.
But what does make sense for you is that that for whatever reason these ancient Americans or ancient tourists came and either came and stayed or came and left, and left this footprint behind of these burial mounds. Now, we were talking about this over the course of years. You had, was it a German TV crew that was following you for a while, was it?
I don't know who they were.
I thought there was somebody that was doing a documentary on it, and I was looking forward to hearing more.
Well, we had a TV crew with us, but there's been somebody that has come to my housing unit here. They drive up in two brand-new Cadillacs. There's four guys in them wearing trench coats to the ground. And I'm sorry, you never need a trench coat to the ground in Phoenix, Arizona.
No.
Nobody in their right mind would wear that kind of clothing, winter or summer or any time. And they came in, they stuck high-def cameras through my window. And when I went out to try and invite them into my home, all they did was nod politely and walk back to the car very slowly, take their cameras, put them in the trunk, and drove slowly out of the parking lot. I don't know who those guys are.
I don't know either. Well, perhaps for another night when you find out more. But you were digging in southern Illinois, and at the time it was an undisclosed location because you were trying to keep as many people from coming and looking over your shoulder while you were doing it. You were working in conjunction with other people. There were lawsuits. There were people fighting over this area and who was going to be able to uncover it. What did you eventually find there? Did you get to the bottom of what you were originally searching for, and what have you found since?
Well, we've taken several expeditions of ground-penetrating radar over the site and found and mapped the underground caves and found five statues and other kinds of square auditoriums. They're small. You know, we're talking about 18 feet by 11 feet, something along those lines, but several rooms in succession down this 1,500-foot corridor. We have not dug the hole. We have put the cameras down and verified that there is a cave down there, but we haven't dug the hole because the patriarchs who own this ground own 6,000 acres of corn. They have, their sons and daughters have been good people, but they have had alternate interests for this. They haven't wanted to have outside people come and mess with their ground. This sits on one of the most pristine groves of lumber in the Midwest. And in the meantime, since the last time we talked, both of the patriarchs have died alternately. The older patriarch and then his wife died and left the ground intestate. However, the son who is likely to inherit this and is in the will, and by the way, that will be adjudicated hopefully by the end of October, and then we will be given final permission to do what we have to do to get into the cave. But the family itself hasn't been willing to sell us the ground. We made them an offer to buy it. That was withdrawn when the patriarchs died, and the ground has been intestate since that time. And we haven't got done what we needed to do. But in the meantime, we haven't stopped searching, nor have we stopped finding artifacts from that region.
All right. Now, your hope was, and your thought was that, I mean, you could barely imagine what might be down there. The thought was that there would not only be many Egyptian artifacts, but also just gold and treasures that you thought could be, you know, priceless, including some reports of other artifacts that, as the local legend had said, had come from that area.
Now, they have actually sold. There's an underground black market of things that have come out of the burial mounds in Illinois. It's quite large, actually. The men who have been digging these things as pirates into the burial mounds have made livings on these artifacts that they've gotten out of it. They've gotten things like, they've even reportedly taken a Jewish menorah, a golden menorah, out of the caves. They've had precious stones taken out of a cave. But more importantly, they've had some 6,000 runestones upon which were detailed histories of people who had been up the Mississippi and lived along the banks of the Ohio or in southern Illinois, which is called Little Egypt to this day.
Down around Cairo, Illinois.
Yeah, around Cairo, Illinois, which is
right.
Was named after Cairo, Egypt.
Right.
But I've been to both places, and they don't resemble each other at all.
Right. Locals don't pronounce it that, though. They call it Cairo, don't they?
Yeah, they call it Cairo.
Okay. And for that matter, then, the link to the University of Southern Illinois Salukis, the Egyptian racing dogs, which,
exactly.
Of all places, why that area would be so linked to ancient Egypt. Well, so have there been new finds, new statuary or anything else that you have come across in this black market that you think is linked to those burial mounds?
Without question, and the next episode or the next issue of the Ancient American magazine, which you can get at www.ancientamerican.com, will feature some of those particular items that we have located. So, and not the least of which is this magnificent Egyptian find, the prayer stone from one of the burial mounds in Illinois.
Well, and is that what you refer to as a type of Rosetta Stone?
It's not Rosetta Stone per se, because we can read Egyptian hieroglyphs very well. The most of the stones that I have seen, and I've seen hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them, were written in a language that almost seemed like pidgin, Greek, Hebrew, and Egyptian mixed together. However, this is not the only place in the Americas where this particular style of writing has been located. Up in Michigan, they have had some rune stones and petroglyphs in this language. In California and Utah, they've had it. And we've now located a professor who has deciphered the code and can read these documents, can read these writings. And they talk about migrations of people from the Near East and from Asia and from Egypt and from Jerusalem directly after the death of Christ, who were fleeing the Romans and the Sadducee persecutions, who fled up the Mississippi to get out of town because it was a dangerous place to be. And they were probably on the hit list. I remember that just after the death of Christ, by the time of 70 AD, Jerusalem was in full-blown war with the Romans.
Sure.
And just after that, the Jews and Christians were being taken to the Colosseum and served up to the lions.
Well, I want you to hold it right there, because when we come back, I want you to give me just a little preview of what you're going to have in this next edition of Ancient American. Tell me about it coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. And Glenn Kimball is back. So the update, for those of you that have been waiting for it, is that there are still problems getting this dig underway. There has always been a property issue. There has always been a sense of complication around the exact area where Glenn and others have wanted to dig. There was a time when it was very promising that there were cameras that were going down this shaft that were showing us something down there. There was verification from various technologies that appeared to be chambers and artifacts in them that you could see the outlines of that were clearly man-made. But still, as of this day, then, there is no new digging in that area, although Glenn is still optimistic that it'll happen. But what they do have from these sites is coming up from the black market. And Glenn's got some photographs and some things to tell us about, things that have been pulled out of the mounds of southern Illinois in this area that is to this day referred to as Little Egypt. We've talked a little bit about why it's called Little Egypt. We'll ask Glenn to give us a preview of what's coming up in the next publication of Ancient American. A run through these photos, including this prayer stone, which they refer to as a kind of Rosetta Stone, in quotes, at ancientamerican.com. We'll ask Glenn more about what they found coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. AncientManuscripts.com is Glenn Kimball's website, and it is from there that I still have several of Glenn's publications, and including the gift you sent me many years ago of the history according to Eusebius, which I use all the time still, and I think of you whenever I do, so thank you for that. And Glenn, I'm looking forward to asking you coming up about the so-called Bible, which is one of your new publications there. And you were on the cutting edge of this. You know, it's funny. There are I don't know, a half dozen books that have come across my desk in the last couple of years of people who are doing the same type of research that you were doing for years, kind of pre-Da Vinci Code, and suddenly a lot of this Gnostic material and these alternative texts came very much into fashion, and people were searching for this material. Hey, where can I actually read it? How can I find out more about it? And I sent many people to your website because I knew that they could purchase it then. But then since then, many bigger books from bigger publishers have come out cataloging a lot of the material. So you are kind of way ahead of the curve on that one, Glenn.
Well, yeah, this is not an issue of jealousy for me. I tend to always be the Robin Hood of history, and I'm not surfing the wave. I'm out there in the ocean in front of the wave a lot of the times. And that's really not very satisfying because I had an experience this last week that was most pointed in this regard. Since I've been doing this research in Mexico, we had a visit from a man who he calls himself the messenger. He lives with the six Mayan tribes that still live under the radar scope in the Yucatan Peninsula. These are tribes that have never been on CNN or ever been filmed in documentaries. They live primarily in the ruins that are only 5% of the ruins of the Yucatan Peninsula have ever been excavated. Or, for that matter, 5% of the ruins in South America have ever been excavated, and that's probably optimistic. There's probably more than that. But
they just can't find them? I mean, or they have them and no one's ever cataloged them? I mean, I'm surprised to hear anything hasn't been excavated.
They haven't even been cataloged. You know, I remember when I was a young man taking the bus ride from La Paz, Bolivia, down over the Andes into the Yungas, into the jungles of the Amazon. And as we were taking that, it almost was like the trip of Tarzan off the escarpment, you know. We were throwing with our huaracas, which were the ancient Aymara slings that you, like David's sling that he slew Goliath with. Mm-hmm. We were throwing oranges off the edge of the cliff, and the orange would disappear before it had hit the ground. That's how scary this ride was. But coming out of the side of these mountains were square stones the size of two buses side by side. And I remember asking the bus driver, well, what is this square stone doing here? He says, oh, well, that's just one of the thousands of ruins that have run around here all the time, you know. And I'm going, holy cow, how many of them are there? And over my years living in South America, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of locations there. And I actually had a chance to live in Mexico. And in addition to Chichen Itza and Teotihuacan and all of those sites which are famous tourist traps, there are thousands more. And there are some tribal people that still live under the canopy, the jungle canopy there, that are legitimate descendants of the Mayan culture, still speak the original Mayan languages. And guess who's one of the people who are some of the people who live with them? Giants. 9.5 foot tall boys. These are not thin little basketball players. These are muscular built people, one of whom came into town here about a month and a half ago into one of the little pueblos in the Yucatan, scared the people half to death, and by the time the CNN cameras got down there, he had already gone back home, and they couldn't find him again.
Hmm.
But they have come and visited us because they have Mayan codexes, Mayan texts. They had 800 pages of them translated into Spanish, and I speak Spanish. My wife is Mexican. And we're looking forward to someday telling the absolutely magnificent story of the ancestors of the Mayans. Of course, we know a lot of the tales already because of the Mayan codexes that exist in our day. We thought that the Indians never wrote anything. They most certainly did.
Well, I want to push it back a second. So this guy, the messenger who made contact with you, he represents these tribes, or is he a part of these?
He's not a part of the tribes. He went down there almost like Carlos Castaneda's did into Oaxaca, into Mexico, and he befriended the tribe. But what he did, and the reason why he became the messenger, is he would take the writings that he had found from one tribal elder to the other one. There are six shaman there that are over 100 years old that he walks continuously amongst these shaman, bringing them the writings, petroglyphs, artifacts from each of the other tribes so that they communicate with each other. And that way he's not the messenger to white Anglo-Saxons. He's the messenger within the tribal councils themselves. He's the bearer of the artifact and of the manuscripts amongst the tribes. And he comes up here twice a year, and we're hoping to have him lecture in our new town in Mexico, And also, we'd like to have the shaman bring their artifacts and place them securely within the control of the Mexican government in the museums in Mexico. It's illegal to own Mexican artifacts in this country, and I highly am supportive of that. Because how many of us have gone to Mexico, including myself when I was young, and talked to the shaman? Camarino, who was the museum curator at Monte Albán, used to take me back to the shaman on several occasions, and I saw some of the artifacts at that time, and they gave me some of them. They gave me a stone statue, which was about a foot and a half high. It was a skeleton with a hollow head made out of stone, which was the symbol of death on the altar of Monte Albán in 1536. And along with that, he had a jade Madonna. This jade Madonna was over a foot high. Just the jade alone must have been worth a small freaking fortune. I told him not to give that to me, that I felt like that was a treasure beyond belief. I brought the symbol of death or the skeleton back with me, and when they passed the law that you could not have Mexican artifacts, I donated it to a museum. I have no artifacts, and I will have no artifacts.
Well, and I want to ask you about the other artifacts from the Little Egypt area in a moment, but I still got to get back to this Mayan tribe thing because I find this so fascinating. And so this messenger fellow, could he lead you back to these Mayan tribes living underneath the canopy and to these 9.5 foot tall giants?
He wants to get permission from the elders. That's why he went back, to get us an invite.
Because, I mean, that would be some serious news for you to take, you know, even just like a camcorder in there and get something. You don't even have to have a big film crew on this at all.
No, you don't. You have to have some people who are not afraid. This is not like taking a trip into the wilds of Kansas, you know.
Right. I mean, what would you fear would happen? I mean, would these Mayan peoples be warrior types? Do you think they would do something to you, being an outsider?
Hey, listen, man. I followed Carlos Castaneda into Oaxaca. You know who Carlos Castaneda is?
Yeah, sure.
I followed him into Oaxaca. That scared the living tar out of me right there.
I bet.
I met the brujas, you know, the witches, the shaman ladies. Nobody wants to do that in their life. That's in their right mind. I mean, when you're young and brave and you mm-hmm. think you want to see God and you want to see spirits and you want to see the spirits walk out of the hills and you sit at their campfires and you think, if I only could see that once in my life, trust me. Think twice before you do that.
Well, you know, but if you get the word out about 9.5 foot tall boys under the canopy, don't worry, you don't have to go in there. Just follow behind the NBA and college scouts. Just walk behind them.
A commission from the agent? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, let them walk point for you, and then you just follow behind them, and then we'll see what happens.
You are a commercial giant. You know that, don't you?
Yeah. All right, so back to the United States. So here in Little Egypt, in the area in southern Illinois, where there are thousands of these burial mounds, when I was raised in Illinois, I was taught to believe that these were all Native American mounds, but you believe that many of them contain artifacts which had to have been extra Native American, had to have come from some other source, including Egyptian statuary, and as you mentioned earlier, a menorah, and perhaps some early first or second century Christian artifacts too.
Right. And if you've been over into Indiana, remember with the site where they have the dove carved in the hill there, the big dove, it looks like the Nazca lines?
I've heard about it. Right.
Well, I've been over there. If you go there, there's a museum right there, and this is going to answer your question. If you go to the museum, it has a picture of the Indians who carved this Nazca-like carving into the mountain. These Indians wore turbans. They wore sleeved shirts and pants. Now, that doesn't sound like Native American Indians in loincloths and feathers. This sounds like more than somebody that's coming out of Egypt. And I didn't do that. I mean, that's on the museum. That's portraying the Native Americans who carved this thing. As a matter of fact, they talked about the people who came over on the Mayflower, that some of the Indians that they found weren't loincloth-bearing Indians either. These were people that were wearing shirts and pants and turbans as well. So where did these people come from? I mean, they're Native American Indians, and by the way, Christopher Columbus may not have been so stupid in calling them Indians because they call themselves the Red Men. The land of the Red Men, or the Rutas, or the Rot or Kem in Egypt, the Phoenicians called themselves the Red Men. These were men who came from the epoch of the Atlantean destruction 11,600 years ago. So the Native American Indians is not just a dumb idea. It really is the land of the Red Men was in the Indonesian islands in India, and certainly the Native American Indians have looked to their far distant ancestors as coming from that area of the world, certainly vindicating another age of time, another people, but mixed in with these tremendous legends of Atlantis is something very curious, because these people, first of all, believed that their civilization was destroyed. Plato says it very clearly in his comments on Atlantis. He says these people were destroyed because of sin or wickedness. Pardon me for the religious illusion. But all four of the civilizations of men that have been recorded in the past all were destroyed for similar reasons. But also, you take books like the Ramayana, who talks about the Shambhala. The Shambhala was the great white knight who would come at the end of the world and lead the sons of God against the sons of darkness, the sons of light against the sons of darkness in one great Armageddon-like battle. Who was that guy? I mean, that seems to be very much rooted in the traditions of the West as well.
Well, and all very interesting. What have you found then, and what has popped up? What do you have photographs of? What's being circulated around on the black market that ties into this area, Little Egypt?
Every single issue of the Ancient American magazine is filled with photos of what we have found, what Wayne has found predominantly, and what we have been showing the world. Wayne is right on top of that. He's the owner of the Ancient American magazine. There are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pictures in these issues. By the way, it's sold at Barnes & Noble now because of its popularity. But you can get a hold of Wayne at ancientamerican.com. It's very close to ancientmanuscripts.com. If you want to get to it, you can go to my website and click on magazines, and it takes you right there. Or you can go to the Coast to Coast website and get there as well.
Are we talking about like what we would think of as maybe like a Sphinx or Nefertiti's, or what kind of things are there that have come up recently out of the black market?
There's some Egyptian motifs, which with definite, you know, one of the runestones that we have is what I call the Stone of Melchizedek, because it says Melchizedek in this pigeon Greek language that they have right on the side of the document. It has this very, very Egyptian-looking man with an Egyptian tunic on and an Egyptian headdress on, standing between two pillars, which, by the way, we want to talk about the two pillars, because the pillars of Hercules are totally significant in the story of not only Atlantis and Alexander the Great, but in the building of the Temple of Solomon. Remember, the two pillars that were outside that temple even had a name given to each one of them. How many people name a pillar in their temple? But they call them Boaz and Joachim. These pillars were totally significant. On this runestone, there are two pillars, and on the side, it identifies this man as being Melchizedek. So that has been found. We have a great motif of the head of a pharaoh. We have a great a runestone with the head of a Moorish sailor, which is a black African sailor from the first century off the northern coast of Africa, in this collection. We have great symbols of Christ on the cross, We have great symbols of Jewish warriors that are found that were at the time of the first century. We have great Roman motifs, Roman army people, basically soldiers that are found in these stones in Illinois. And, you know, why historians have denied that any of these things have ever existed. And yet in history, there was the Cave of the Mouth, which Wayne took me to up the Mississippi, which we used to be covered with Egyptian hieroglyphs. And we went up the Mississippi to find that, and we did find it. And today most of those have been destroyed. But historians don't like this. They do not like the fact that these things have ever existed. I even think about Buffalo Bill Cody, when he, you know, the one that did the Old West show.
Sure, the Wild West shows.
He was brought by Sitting Bull some bones of giants from Sitting Bull and his nation, and he was told that these were the men from the epoch before our epoch of time. And he took these bones and gave them to under protectorship to universities, and they never have surfaced again. But Buffalo Bill Cody writes of these things.
Well, I want you to hang on to that thought, because I know that you talk about the role that giants play in the beliefs between Upper and Lower Egypt too, and maybe we can tie all these together. And what epoch are we entering into now, as we are rolling out of one into another? We'll ask Glenn Kimball about that next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. I'm going to enjoy talking about these updates with Glenn Kimball, and we have more on the way here in just a minute. And we'll open up the phones a little bit later on this hour so that you can join the conversation too. And we'll pick up this thought about giants, what we left off on last hour. But whatever the updates are, you know, you can always find a whole magazine of updates all the time. The Coast to Coast newsletter, After Dark. If you haven't taken a look at an issue recently, you really don't know what you're missing. You not only get the latest information from this show, but also you can see and read about information before it ends up on the air. And 1-888-727-5505 is the number where you can order the After Dark newsletter. And they have this special offer, a limited time offer, from the archives of Coast to Coast AM. An interview with Reverend Malachi Martin, Father Malachi Martin, and our friend Art Bell. And this goes back to, I think, 1997. The Perfect Possessions compact disc comes with your order. It's 1-888-727-5505. And in the current edition right now, they have a really interesting article on people who survive only by breathing, only on air. Other than supermodels. And you can read about it in the After Dark newsletter, 1-888-727-5505. And I hope that if Glenn Kimball were ever to get a video of these 9.5-foot tall giants in the Yucatan living under the canopy with these Mayan tribes, we would get a photo of that in After Dark. What we do have, though, is a discussion about other aspects of these giants as they relate to history in Glenn's research next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Well, we're talking with Glenn Kimball, who has been researching ancient manuscripts for a long time at ancientmanuscripts.com, and also ancient Americans and ancient American tourists. And all of these are rolled into this conversation plus more, because you were just talking about this. And I want to give you a moment here to kind of explain a little bit your thought about the various epochs of human history. Where are we? What group are we in right now? Because we had a call on our very first hour when we were doing open lines about entering into kind of a golden age around 2112, which of course ties us back into the Mayans again, doesn't it?
It ties us back into the Mayans. It ties us back into the people from Atlantis. It ties us back into the first epoch of time, the Golden Age, the Silver Age, and the Bronze Age. These four epochs of human beings have come and gone through cataclysms. But in the discussion about the giants, first of all, I want to give credit to Stephen Quayle, who's written that great book, Genesis 6, Giants. And on my website, I've combined that with my new CD called Pre-Genesis, The Time Before the Beginning, which is absolutely critical. And I haven't really wanted to do this CD, to be honest with you, Ian, because you know my agendas, and it opens up a whole new can of worms when you start talking about epochs of time. You get positioned right between the creationists and the evolutionists, and both sides hate your guts, you know, for what you say.
Where do you go with this? Because aren't you seeing giants in evidence of giants in this in the contrast between Upper and Lower Egypt too?
Yes, I am, and plus the fact, see, when I was young, I used to think the tale of giants was a fantasy. But when I lived in Peru, I had the opportunity was invited to a private gold museum, which had two mummified kings in it. And as I was going through this magnificent, huge gold museum with thousands of artifacts of gold, there were two mummies there. These two mummies were 9.5 feet tall. I took pictures of me next to them. Their gloves had fingers that were 10 inches long. Their crowns on their heads I could put two of my head inside the crown. They had woven gold tunics, which were like tapestries because the gold was spun into a tapestry-like effect. These cloaks that they used were 14 feet high. And then the amount of treasure that they had that they took out of this tomb where these giant kings were was a king's ransom.
Are they still on display?
They still very much are. And, you know, as a young man, I thought, well, that's cool. I mean, the NBA would love this one. You know, they could dunk the basketball at eye level.
Right. I mean, they could pat Yao Ming on the head. They've X-rayed these mummies. I mean, they're not just stuffed sheets, you know, but they have the actual bones
not.
And the skeletal.
Absolutely not. They were real, bona fide, tangible mummies. Two of them. One of them was 9.5 feet tall, and the other one was 10 foot tall.
And where could somebody go and see them today?
Lima, Peru.
Okay, in Peru. And so how does that tie in with Egypt?
Well, remember that these giants. One of the very first authors about the giants was Philo, obviously, and you know who Philo was.
Sure.
Philo was born in 20 BC and died in 50 AD and lived during the entire lifetime of Christ. And he was a scholar in Alexandria, Egypt. He was a Jewish scholar who rewrote the entire history, a secondary history of the Old Testament, but embedded in these 1,000 pages of documents was a chapter on the giants. Now, this Philo was the guy who was referenced by Cecil B. DeMille when he created the movie The Ten Commandments. He comes out from behind the curtain and says, this movie, The Ten Commandments, with Charlton Heston and Yul Brynner, etc., is based on the Holy Bible, the Midrash, and Philo. He took the history for making the movie The Ten Commandments out of Philo. And Philo was the one who chronicled the giants from Egypt, from the perspective of the Egyptians. So, in other words, these giants were very much a prominent entity in Egypt. And by the way, they had their counterpart, which were very short people. The Celtics called them the Yozlings. Now, these dwarf-type people were the engineers who helped build the pyramids. When I was with Zahi Hawass took me on a personal tour of the Giza Plateau, and he took me someplace that he had never taken any white people before, any Americans before. He took me to the tomb of the man who was the engineer behind the building of the Khufu Pyramid. And I said nothing to him because, you know, you don't tell Zahi anything. You listen when you're in the presence of Zahi. He's a great man, but he does all the talking. When he took me inside this thing, he showed me the hieroglyph and the image of this engineer, and he said, this man was a midget. This man was a short person. And I went, ka-ching! That coincides with everything that I know about the relationship with the giants who helped build these giant megalithic structures, and the short people were the ones who were the engineers behind all of this sort of thing. And this comes from a time period that's mentioned in the Bible. When the Bible mentions giants, these giants come from an epoch that sunk with Atlantis in Indonesia and India in the South China Sea, some 11,600 years ago, and some of them survived. And they survived, and they were called men of old or men of renown in the Bible. So, and when Amerigo Vespucci he followed Christopher Columbus into the Americas. Many people think that the Americas was named after Amerigo Vespucci, which is not the case. But when he came to the Caribbean, he actually met the giants in the Caribbean and in the northern coast of Venezuela. So did Magellan. So did Vasco da Gama. Every single one of the early explorers had an encounter with the giants in this land, and the Native American Indians still talk about him to this very day. And I was one of the very first white people ever to go to Tiahuanaco, which is in the high plains near La Paz, Bolivia, right on the shores of Titicaca. And Tiahuanaco is a magnificent city, but the big megalithic structure there that they have right at the door to the temple, this great statue of this Inca king, I was looking at him, and I started counting his fingers. He has six fingers.
On each hand.
On each hand, and six toes on each foot. And I'm going, well, either they could not count, which is extremely unlikely.
Right.
Or something's going on here.
But that may account for why at one point we had a base six math language. Could it be that because I had six? We were what a sexadecimal system once. Could be.
You and I have to go write for Disney one of these days.
Well, tell me. So, this idea. I mean, this thing about giants. I mean, if the giants still exist and they're still in the Yucatan and they live under the canopy, I would still think that there would be some expeditions that would have gone into this area, some written record or photographic record that would exist if there were still a race of people that tall today.
You know, and I would presume the same thing, but having lived in the third world, you know, we have a presumption here in America, and it's kind of like the prime directive. The prime directive is we know everything, and nothing exists unless we know it.
Right.
Having lived in the third world, I realized that Americans are next to ignorant as stones about the history of the world. We know next to nothing about what has happened in the world. We know nothing about Egypt. We know nothing about the history of Sanskrit. We know nothing about the Hindus. We know nothing about China. We certainly do not know anything about the Americas. The fact that we're finding Egyptian motifs up the Mississippi and Jewish motifs up the Mississippi and Moorish sailors up the Mississippi, and the fact that we have found giants in South America and thousands of archaeological sites. And to give you an example, where is the largest pyramid by volume located in the world?
Mexico.
St. Louis.
Get out!
Did you know that?
I knew of one in Memphis, but I thought it was a stadium. I didn't know that.
It's called Monk's Mound. It's right there on the freeway. Big sign, biggest pyramid in the world. We got to read the signs on the freeway.
Yeah, really. I have to go to St. Louis. I haven't been to St. Louis in years. So it's the largest in terms of volume, meaning it's stone, or is it earth?
The mound
pyramid?
Is still there, the dirt mound, but underneath it is a stone pyramid. They drilled it. There's a stone pyramid underneath it.
Huh. And do they? I'm assuming they've already been in it, and they've already found whatever was left to be found.
They have taken. They're just in the beginnings of the excavation of the stone underneath it. They've taken ultrasonics, and there are caves that go in all four directions from that pyramid. Go north, south, east, and west.
Didn't know. So, what age are we entering into then?
We are in the fifth and the last age, the very last age, which was predicted by the people of Atlantis, the people of the Golden Age. All the epics of time talked about five ages. The Greeks called it best. The Greeks are the ones that really, and the where the Greeks got their information from was from the Hindus or the Dravidas or the Sanskrit, which are the oldest documents on the planet. Some people say the Sumerian texts were the oldest. I'm sorry, that's not it. The Sanskrit is the oldest language in the world. They are the ones the closest to the time period of these epics before time. And I wanted to give you a little bit of a scenario. What we do in the Western world is we tend to take one single piece of a manuscript and we tend to construct our histories based on it. For example, Plato talks about Atlantis, and this is just a great example. We've taken all of our searches for Atlantis from Plato, but you can't find Atlantis by just searching Plato. You have to take all of the manuscripts that exist, especially the ones from India, Egypt, and the Americas, and the alternate sources from Greece and from Alexandria, Egypt, and from Alexander the Great, in order to be able to find this place. Because the Atlantis was supposed to be associated with a great fiery explosion, which, in my opinion, it was the explosion of Krakatoa in 11,600 years ago, but it was also associated with a place called the Ocean of Milk. Now, Ocean of Milk, you go, what in the world are you talking about?
I thought it was Sea of Milk.
Well, Sea of Milk or Ocean of Milk, depending upon which of the two texts you're talking about.
Right.
But the Ocean of Milk or the Sea of Milk came from the idea that the ash from Krakatoa filled the ocean with so densely that it turned it white and unnavigable. That didn't happen at Thule in the Mediterranean. It did not happen in the Americas. As a matter of fact, if you come to the Americas, you go to all the tribes on the western coast of the American hemisphere, all of them look toward the west as their homeland. Their motherland, where they came from. All the Indian tribes on the eastern coast look to the eastern coast as their homeland, the origins. And it all converges back to the Ultima Thule, or the Great Divide in history, which is one of the oldest concepts in Sanskrit. The Ultimate Divide is where, and in Egypt, by the way, they looked east and west too. The place where they converged was in the South China Sea, the Indias and India. That's why they were looking in both directions, is because if you looked around the world, it converged at that particular location. So we live in the last epoch of time, and all of the other epochs talked about a time when the Atlanteans talked about when the Atlantis would come, the environment of Atlantis would be restored to the world toward the end of the Fifth Age. The Golden Age knew about it, the Silver Age knew about it, sort of the Bronze Age knew about it. They all talked about the very last epic returning to this peaceful time. And in Christian religion, we talk about a millennial era of time after the second coming, where there'd be peace in the land, where the devil would be bound, where there'd be no more political parties. And one of the things that would precipitate that would be some sort of cataclysm that always ended these epics of time. They always ended in a cataclysm. And one of the most magnificent things I have, and it's is the writings from the actual Colburn Bible on this issue. Now, to explain to you what the Colburn Bible is, the Colburn Bible was the Bible that Longshanks, or Edward I, was looking for to destroy. Remember the movie Braveheart?
Mm-hmm.
Longshanks. He was looking for this Bible to destroy it. He ended up burning the Glastonbury Abbey to the ground looking for it. What was the Colburn? The Colburn was the Bible of Joseph of Arimathea, the Virgin Mary, and company. And those things survived until 1184, and when they burnt the Glastonbury Abbey to the ground, this Bible went underground. And it's been underground for 850 years, and it has resurfaced.
The Colburn Bible has?
Yes.
Who has it?
The Chaldean Society. I've spoken to them over the last 3 years. Their first comments to me was, we're not going to let you translate this into English and publish it in America under any circumstances, until recently, when they have told me via email that they have decided to allow me to do that, but they have to take care of some legal matters first before they do it. It's my opinion that they will allow me to do that in the coming year.
Is it in Gaelic?
No, it's in English.
Translate it meaning what? Then?
From the Gaelic.
Okay.
Now, there are copies of it in the Lebanese Museum.
Yeah.
There's copies of it in the Vatican. Now, these exist in separate documents, much like our Bible were separate books.
Mm-hmm.
This was combined into a book called the Colburn. I call it the Colburn Bible, and has been preserved in our day. And by the way, I include quotes from the creation story, which tell us the real creation of the earth, which includes the coming of Adam and Eve, which includes the other epochs of time, how they were destroyed, and how these great societies, when these cataclysms came, and these men who had great knowledge and power and engineering skills, when these cataclysms came, they went underground to hide from these cataclysms, and they went mad. And the same thing would happen in our day. If we had a meteor hit the East Coast, the people in Arizona go underground, they go crazy. Of course, we're half crazy out here anyway. We're halfway already too crazy. But these people reverted back to cavemen every epoch of time.
Well, at least then they wouldn't have to dig too far. Let's hold on this thought, too, because I want to open up the phones. We'll give all the numbers coming up in just a minute. And then I want you to take a little time to explain the so-called B Bible, okay?
Okay.
Because that's your new publication that's out?
Well, actually, it's one of them, yes.
In one of them, at ancientmanuscripts.com. Sounds very interesting. And then Glenn also has some new compact discs that are available at Ancient Manuscripts. And you can find out more, too, about Glenn's work in Ancient American Magazine. We're getting an update on all of the adventures of Glenn Kimball, both in the United States and, surprisingly, the work that's going on in Mexico with these Mayan tribes and the stories of these 9.5-foot-tall boys coming out of the jungle from the Yucatan. Also, your questions, your comments for Glenn Kimball next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. In the midway between Minneapolis and St. Paul, actually, and I thank Tony for passing along this information, he went on line and he grabbed and printed out for me about the mound there that Glenn Kimball was just talking about, Monk's Mound. I've never seen it, and it's very interesting. They believe that there's a total volume here in this pyramid, this earthen pyramid, in which somewhere inside are stones. It's a 21 million, roughly 21,700,000 cubic feet. A structure that was the largest on Earth until the building of the Pentagon and skyscrapers in the 20th century. And they don't actually know a lot about it. They've done some drilling. They've encountered stones about 140 feet in and 40 feet below the second or the top of the second terrace of this. And it is similar to other types of mounds, like in Cartersville, Georgia, and Poverty Point, Louisiana, and in Miamisburg, Ohio, although that one in Miamisburg is more conical than pyramidal. Still, it's a fascinating subject, maybe one we can look into more coming up in the months ahead on Coast to Coast AM. And quick correction, I believe I was talking about the Mayan time, and I refer to it as 2112. For whatever reason, the album by the band Rush jumped to mind, which was 2112. The time we should be talking about is 2012, and I thought I'd correct me before you do. Coming up, we'll go Coast to Coast AM with your calls coming up next for Glenn Kimball on all of his research, and we'll get an update on one of his new books on his website, The Bee Bible. It's actually very interesting book. I had also never been familiar with this. Maybe you have. We'll tell you about it next on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Talking with Glenn Kimball, the lines are being answered as we speak. We'll get to them in just a moment. And Glenn, before we do, I don't want to lose a moment here to talk about the Bee Bible. Tell me about that. What is the Bee Bible?
There are many Bibles. We talked about the Koran. We know about the Holy Bible. The Kibra Nagast is the Bible from Africa. Obviously, the B Bible, well, not obviously, but the B Bible was the Bible that's been used for 2,000 years by Christians in China. This is right after the death of Christ. They had, John the Beloved had a mission to the Far East, along the Silk Trade routes. There's still chapels or churches or temples along the Silk Trade routes, which are called the Churches of John. And he took with him a copy of scriptures, which has been come to known as the Bee Bible. Now, the tribes of Israel have always been symbolized by the beehive. And this Bee Bible is still recognized in the Eastern Orthodox Church as a authentic Bible. We don't know anything about it in the West. This is another part of our ignorance. We have absolutely no conception that there is another Bible that the Chinese have used for 2,000 years, even older than our Greek versions of the Bible. We have also the Aramaic Bible, which is on my website, which, you know, Christ, the people of Christ's time in Jerusalem didn't speak Greek. I mean, maybe Christ did, but his people spoke Aramaic and Hebrew. We have a pristine copy of the entire Bible translated from the Aramaic, which gives a completely refreshing view on the Bible. People are always focused on Bibles. I like talking about extra-biblical things as well, but they focus on the Bibles. I've combined these things all with the combination of getting my new CD, The Greatest Story Ever Told, which is pre-Genesis, The Time Before the Beginning. And we'll give a toll-free number for those who don't have the internet later on in the program. But the B Bible very definitely is something that they've used actively for 2,000 years in China.
What's different about it?
How many people suffered persecution because they followed this B Bible protocol when in reality the major religions were Taoism and Buddhism and et cetera, Confucianism. And here are these people who spring out and are very definitely Christians and have their own version of the Bible.
Shoot me a copy of that. I'd love to take a look at it, if you would. Let's go to the international line for Mary in Canada for Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. Mary?
Hi. It's so wonderful to talk to you, Ian. I'm glad you're on the Coast to Coast staff. And
thank you.
I love your choice of guests, which leads me to Glenn. Glenn, you're probably aware that astronomers say that the Star of Bethlehem actually occurred about 6 or 7 years prior to the birth of Christ, which would put us not in 2005, but in 2011 or 2012 now, according to the Mayan calendar. So what do you think? Do you agree with this? And what do you think, we're that close to the last great age?
Well, I think I was probably one of the very first people to go public with the fact that Christ was really born in 7 B.C. and died in 33 A.D. and was 40 when he died. You know, Dionysius Ignatius, who was selected to give the zero point for the Julian calendar in 533 A.D., made a mistake. He didn't take into account the census that was taken in 6 B.C., which was it was only taken every 12 years, so and Herod had already died in 4 B.C., so Jesus had to have been born before that. But you talk about calendar systems ending. The Mayan calendar talks about the year 2012, but you got to remember that the Inca calendar ended in 2011, and the Jewish calendar, believe it or not, and it's very unknown, really well known by anybody, ends in 2008. And people say, well, what are we talking about here? Are we talking about December 21st, the year 2012? Based on the Mayans' estimation, my comment is, who knows? You know, the Bible says that not even the angels in heaven know, and that he'll come like a thief in the night. I don't know. I know that if it were me trying to predict the future, I really don't like trying to predict the future. I'm against trying to pose as a prophet when I have absolutely no tendencies whatsoever for prophetic language.
But it's an interesting thought that perhaps, again, this time shift, this difference between how we mark time and how the Mayans mark time, that if we look at that as ending at 2012, then we are already there.
Well, so, that's, we're adding apples and oranges to some extent. The 2012 is based on the number of years from the Mayan calendar. The Mayans never had the Julian calendar. So this is superfluous to the Julian calendar.
Okay.
They gave us a quantity of years from that would end in our Julian calendar at the age of 2012. It has nothing to do with the birth of Christ.
But then is this a coincidence that it parallels our 2012?
They didn't say the year 2012 in the Mayan calendar.
Okay.
It's a quantity of years that ends in our Julian version of the 2012.
So their quantity of years, and we assign it that value.
That's correct.
Let's go west of the Rockies. Brian on Coast to Coast AM. Brian for Glenn Kimball.
Yeah, this is Brian for San Diego.
Glad to have you.
First, I'm glad to talk to you, and your guest is very intelligent.
Thank you. Nice to have you here. What's your question?
Well, my question was, are these giants angels? But really what I wanted to say is, I'm collecting data from all these, the pyramids and the angels and when Christ was born. I have a theory. I have the key to time travel.
But
my name is not Brian.
Okay. Well, thank you, Brian, or whatever your name is. I welcome you to email more on that so we can hear about it. First-time caller line, Bobby is hanging on for Glenn Kimball. Go ahead, Bobby.
Hi, this is Bobby from Phoenix, Arizona. And I was just wondering if your guest knew anything about the Nephilims.
Nephilim?
Yeah, Nephilim, sorry.
Yeah, it's okay.
Well, the Nephilim obviously refer to the fallen angels. better translated, these are the sons of God who survived the Atlantean era of time. The first human age, the Golden Age, were supposedly great angelic beings who never died and who became our guardian angels. And their descendants survived. You know, there were remnants, very, very small numbers of remnants that went from the first age to the second age to the third age by hiding underground in caves or preserving themselves on the tops of mounds, et cetera, et cetera. The Nephilim refers to the first age of man who were the first humanoids on the planet, human beings on the planet, and they call themselves the sons of God. And they call themselves fallen angels only because their societies became wicked and were destroyed by cataclysms.
Bobby, did you have a question beyond that? Okay, let's go to east of the Rockies where Mike is hanging on for Glenn Kimball, ancientmanuscripts.com. Mike?
Hi, Ian. Hi, Glenn. I would like to make a comment for the benefit of all people who might think that Glenn is off the wall or a bit strange. One should really give pause because if you look at the DNA of different nationalities and ethnic groups of people today, I don't mean the mitochondrial DNA, but the nuclear DNA, which I think tells a lot more. It turns out that Semites, i.e. Arabs, Jews, and their relatives, Latinic people, that is Italians, you know, the ancient Romans and the relatives of the Italians like the Romanians, and also the Greeks have 1/8 of their DNA Native American. And also there was corn in India in the 1200s. By corn, I mean maize, you know, American corn, which evolved in Mexico. The closest wild relatives of corn occur in Mexico. And so it had to have originated there. And yet it occurs in India since the 1200s.
And, Mike, while that is very interesting,
if you look that up in the Wikipedia, you can find confirmation.
I'm sure you can. Although the Wikipedia says something very odd about me. Somebody sent me what the Wikipedia, just how they describe me, and I'm still getting over that. But, Mike, can I just say that even if that's true,
Yes.
I still reserve the right to think that Glenn Kimble is weird. Okay, I just want to. I'm still holding on. I think I'm gonna do that. I'm gonna off the wall is what I'll still use.
But he's good off the wall.
I'm good off the wall. He's a good bank off the wall. Glenn, you have a comment on what Mike said?
Well, yeah. We talk about the Toltecs and the Mayans. First of all, to make a comment, the Toltecs had a separate calendar from the Mayans, but both of them end on December 21st, 2012, and they were derived by different means. I think that's really important to suggest. But the Toltecs were famous for something very interesting. They were famous for being a city of commerce. They had absorbed their neighbors not through warfare, but because they were such big craftsmen and merchants. They absorbed the surrounding communities because they were getting rich off the trade worldwide. They were trading with Egypt. They were trading with the Far East. They were the source of gold, tin, silver, the spices, et cetera, until they were conquered by the Aztecs, who were a warring tribe from the north. The Toltecs were a peaceful people. And part of the reason why I named the new city in Mexico the way I did, as I called it the city of Tlalpan, which was the city of the major capital city of the Toltecs, I named it after the Toltecs because it was a city of peace, a city of craftsmen, a city of trade. And by the way, not only did they have mice in the Far East, but if you look at the ancient Egyptians, they were of the nine German sarcophaguses that are in the German museums today, the pharaonic mummies, they did toxicology reports on their hair. All of them had cocaine in their hair, which is only grown in the Andes, and they were all mummified with tobacco in their stomachs. And approximately between 80% and 90% of all the pharaonic mummies in Egypt do have cocaine traces in their toxicology. And were mummified with tobacco, and that's not the only substances that were traded to Egypt and back and forth.
Let's go international line where David is calling from Canada for Glenn Kimble on Coast to Coast AM. David,
good morning, gentlemen.
Good morning.
I'm just calling to refer to your partner there, Glenn. I'm just curious if you have a religious doctrine on your studies, or if this is just a personal pleasure.
It's actually an excellent question. I wish I could tell you that I did. I really do. The reality is I'm a great follower of the man who doesn't have a name tag. I hesitate to even use it on the program. I am very much a follower of the man who the Hindus called the antecedent of the Tao. Now, the ancient Sanskrit symbol of the Tao was a cross. This would be a messianic figure who would come at the end of the last fifth age, die on a cross, and be resurrected. There's been many people who died on crosses from the time of Julius Caesar who invented crucifixion, but none of them claimed, except one, to be resurrected. And this idea of resurrection was also a common theme in all the previous four epochs of time of humanoids. It ties everything in together. You cannot speak of the histories of these people without speaking in the language that they spoke based on the values that they had. And those values tie into our values in our modern day. I wish I could say it any more plainly than that, but I think it's pretty clear to me and to you that we're talking about a very similar thing. I have a little analogy to give you. There are many historians like Oman who've written books like Christianity, an Egyptian religion, Moses and Akhenaten, and the Hebrew pharaohs of Egypt. These men suggested that our Judeo-Christian concepts come from Egypt or from Hindus or from Sanskrit or from the Sumerian tablets, etc., etc. That is not the case, and let me tell you why. If you were to predict in our day that in 100 years from now there would be no trees left, if you were to go 100 years from now and find no trees, it wouldn't make you a big profit because we're looking at not having trees anyway if we keep on going the way we are with over a billion trees cut every year. It doesn't make you very special. But if you were to say, I'm going to, in 100 years from now, go into a forest and a tree is going to talk to me, and then all of a sudden all the other trees are going to talk to me, that would be a bizarre claim.
And then 100 years from now, if you were to walk into a forest and trees were talking to you, that you'd be counted one of the major prophets of all time. The reality is that the prophecies of these ancient civilizations is no less fantastic. That a man would rise from the dead and be die on a cross and rise from the dead is no less fantastic than trees talking. I mean, this is not something that you could predict and have it logically or coincidentally happen. It just doesn't happen by coincidence. This is a major connection that runs through the thread of all the epochs of time.
I find that answer fascinating, but Glenn, I got to be honest with you. When he started with, is there any particular doctrine you follow? I'm having a hard time remembering how we got from doctrine you follow to talking trees. But I'm really into what you're saying.
Well, that's a Celtic illusion, to be honest.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. Let's go west of the Rockies where Chuck is hanging on. We'll get one caller in before the top of the hour for our friend Glenn Kimball. Go ahead, Chuck.
Yes, I'm calling from Fairbanks, Alaska, and I have a question for Glenn. Has he heard anything or followed up on any ancient advanced cultures in the Arctic here in Alaska?
That's a great question. That's a super, super question. We don't hear much about the Arctic in that way.
Well, I think you would find some magnificent stories about the Alaska and the Eskimos found in a book called He Walked the Americas by L. Taylor Hansen. The only place I know you could get a copy of it anymore is off my website. Tells the stories of the ancient peoples from the as they tell their own, the Eskimos tell their own stories.
Right.
Most of our historians tell us that they crossed the isthmus at the end of the last ice age on foot. And my comment to them is, historians, you're nuts.
All right. Well, I actually wondered about how you felt about the Bering Strait theory. So I'll ask you more about that, too, here in just a second on where you think they did come from. Interesting stories coming out of Alaska with all the ice melting, all these new species they're finding off the coast. And speaking of which, we'll come back Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. And thank you, too, for heading into our last hour with Brian and Robert and Gary and another Brian all hanging on the phones for Glenn Kimball, our guest. And I look forward to getting everybody on here coming up. We do have, I guess, one or two open wild card lines, if that encourages you to call. And we had just left off with a thought about the Bering Strait theory. And, Glenn, you were expressing your disbelief in that. Where do you think, then, Native Americans came to this country from?
Well, certainly there were people who could have gone on followed the coastlines, but after the Pleistocene age, these things were largely covered with glaciers, and it was not a footpath like the footpaths of Rome that led to all four corners of the earth that you could cover on engineered roads. The majority of the people who came to the Americas came here via ocean vessels. the Atlanteans were called the people of the ocean, the people of the mariners. The Toltecs called themselves the people of the boats. And when I was in Egypt last year, one of the things that they did with all the pharaohs, Thutmose III and Akhenaten, etc., when they took them into the Holy of Holies of the temples in Karnak, was the fact they carried them on boats. They worshipped boats. Why did they worship boats? People will say, well, they were going to sail away into the sun. No. Boats were their livelihood. These people had a mariner ability far beyond what we've ever expected them to have. The people came to the Americas via the ocean and always have come via the ocean.
There's been some very interesting research on the Chinese, the ancient Chinese mariners coming to the California coast and then into Mexico.
Certainly. And one of the books on my website is the I'm trying to read it here. It's called When China Ruled the Seas, and this is a history of China visiting the Americas before Christopher Columbus.
Right.
And they had huge vessels with hundreds of people on these vessels that came to the Americas long before Christopher Columbus.
Before. Let's go west of the Rockies for our friend Glenn Kimball. This is Brian, and I guess you all have a little bit of a connection, Brian?
Yeah, just slightly. Thank you so much for taking my call. It's a big thrill.
Thank you.
Mr. Kimball, I was the artist who painted pictures on Stephen Quayle's website of the mummies in Peru.
Wonderful.
I don't know if you've seen these pictures.
I haven't seen them.
If you go to Stephen Quayle's website, I painted a picture of the mummy in the Gold Museum. He's sitting on a stone wall wearing that large shirt, the golden shirt.
Well, now, Brian, are there also photographs of those?
Yes, on Steve Quayle's site, there is some photographs of them, and I became enamored with these things when I visited Japan and found some giant artifacts in the in a museum in Japan.
Oh.
And I took pictures of them and drew pictures and put them on the website, and Steve called me, and then I researched Glenn's things just on the website, and from small photographs on that website, I painted pictures of these of a couple of giants. One is a direct wearing the headdress that Glenn had actually photographed and the large shirt, and that's on the website too. So
that shirt is not like a t-shirt.
No.
Is bigger than I am.
Yes, well, when you see that picture, you'll realize what a large man that's he's sitting on our stone wall next to a regular sized person.
You know, it's interesting, when we think about giants, I think and I'm not trying to stereotype, but we don't think necessarily of them being mental giants, right? I mean, we think of giants, we tend to think of people who are slower or less acute or somehow malformed. In fact, in most of our lore, giants are just kind of dumb. So, but that's not your impression of these types of giants, right, Glenn?
Not at all. These people were brilliant. Many of them had customs were not too nice. Some of them were cannibals, for example. But these people weren't stupid at all. Nor were they tall, thin people that would play basketball. Some of these people were muscular individuals.
Okay.
Anything but skinny.
I wonder, has Brian done any illustrations of them eating anybody?
No.
Okay. Right, just checking.
Not all of them were, and I don't believe that the Inca kings were, because they certainly were the kings of an entire Inca civilization, and you wouldn't be eating your neighbors. That's not one thing you do to get to be king, you know.
At least unless you're doing a reality TV show.
Oh, that's true. I forget about that.
Brian, thank you so much for jumping in.
Thank you very much.
Have a terrific night. We'll come back for more of these. The phones are lighting up for Glenn Kimball for the rest of this hour on Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Let's run the table on the phones for Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. We'll pick it up with Robert on the east of the Rockies. Hey, Robert.
Good morning. This is a super program. It's going to be one of my favorite recordings.
Oh, thank you.
Say, what Mr. Kimball's most recent comments in the last few moments here seem to substantiate my question, maybe, but a friend of mine is in the I Am religious movement, and these people seem to think that the Indians were not the first people on this continent either. I'm wondering if Mr. Kimball has any relativity about the I Am movement and their information involving this.
I think I saw something about that on your site, didn't I, Glenn?
I really try and stay away from talking about specific religions if I can. But you're right. The Native American Indians were L. Taylor Hansen was not. She was not coming from a religious agenda at all. Agnostic probably would best describe her. She was a professor at Southern Cal. The book He Walked the Americas is absolutely brilliant. But, you know, commenting back to your comment from the last caller when he said, are the giants stupid? Remember that when Joshua was at Jericho, at the walls of Jericho, one of the white giants came to him and taught him how to bring down the walls using a superior knowledge. Joshua was taking advice from one of the giants. These people were people who had superior knowledge in the world. They weren't stupid people.
Okay. Let's get to first-time caller line Gary for Glenn Kimball. And, Robert, I refer you to Glenn's website. My answer more to that question, by the way, ancientmanuscripts.com. Gary?
Yes, sir.
You're talking with Glenn.
I've been listening, so my question has changed a little bit. Geneticists, I believe, currently are saying between 4 and 9 family groups, mostly out of Asia, are all the native populations in the Americas. So I'm assuming they discount any information they find that doesn't agree with that.
Well, you know, we have a little bit of a problem. Are you familiar with Sam Chang's work on the junk DNA?
Not offhand, no, sir.
Okay, Sam Chang, this is very recent material, by the way. And by the way, it's on my CD, Pre-Genesis, Time Before the Beginning. I quote from Sam Chang. The most recent DNA research is that we only use 3% of our DNA to synthesize the proteins and peptides, etc., that we use to create everything about us, including our hair color, our behavior, our ancestors, etc. 97% of the coding on the DNA strand is not random, is not unusable. You can read the codes from this DNA. We talk about using that 3% to try and decipher the genetic heritage of everybody. When in reality, what's encoded in the 97% that we don't use? Sam Chang's compatriot, Adnan, reaches the conclusion. He says, you know, we're going to have to rethink, and these are two very agnostic people. He says, we're going to have to, in our day, DNA is going to force us into rethinking our entire concept of evolution, because it could not possibly have occurred as we have stated in the past. Because the encoding in the 97% tells us of a history that is not being used by humans in our day. And he says, this is obviously some sort of roadmap to the creator of life throughout the universe. Now, this is very curious for people who are not religious, who are not, don't have a dogma to contend with. We talk about the Native American Indians. They obviously were a very heterogeneous population in terms of where they came from. That's why the Indians on the East Coast looked to the East for their ancestors. The Indians on the West Coast looked to the West for their ancestors. Certainly their ancestors came from Egypt. They came from India. They came from Indonesia. They came from Jerusalem. They came from Europe. There were multiple migrations, multiple adventures, multiple happenings here in the Americas that we have yet to chronicle in our day.
Very interesting. Gary, does that answer the question?
Partially. I was wondering, you know, if you really wanted to prove this, the Mormons have been doing a lot of research into Egypt and whatnot. If they could had a family line that are almost certain died out before Columbus left, and if you compare them to groups that perhaps individuals have been discounted here, that you might be able to prove a pre-European or Near East genetic connection that would had to have been here before Columbus sailed.
Well, without any doubt, when I was with Camarino, who was the museum curator in Monte Albán, when I was following Carlos Castaneda's in Oaxaca, this was the very first time I had ever heard about the Native Americans having a European Asian heritage to them. And there's a piece of the tailbone of the coccyx that is very, very Oriental in nature, which is also stems from a more ancient society, which are the people that are pre-Genesis in epoch and come from the Atlantean period of time. Atlantis was not just a location. Atlantis was a culture worldwide. So the people are looking at the Bimini Road and the sunken cities off the coast of Cuba, the sunken cities in Lake Titicaca and in the Pacific off the Andes Mountains. All of these civilizations were part of the Atlantean culture, because these were seafaring people. But the heart of the civilization and their predecessors, the Mu or the Lemurians, some 20,000 years ago instead of 11,600 years ago, both of these cultures were very seafaring. They traveled the world and had connection with cultures around the world.
It's Brian on the wildcard line for Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. Brian?
Good morning, Mr. Ian. Good morning, Mr. Glenn.
Good morning.
Actually, I have a logical train of everything you guys have been saying. And it takes you back before the break before the last break.
Okay.
You're talking about the mind calendar.
Right.
Okay. Ian, to link your shows to many that George has done, a couple that Art's done that I've heard, the Egyptians, I'm not going to say, there have been found pyramids in within Mayan walls and all this other stuff, and there have been found pyramids elsewhere that links to schematics that was used for the Heralded pyramids in Egypt. Could it be possible that, and by doing this logically, you have to say that maybe to say rule the world, we have to lessen the definition to simply maybe influence the world. But was Egypt where the first world rulership came on to leave an impression for future generations, not necessarily control it?
Glenn?
Well, that conversation broke up a little bit, but most of the historians would say that our civilization stemmed from Africa. I'm not positive. In fact, I'm almost nearly certain that that's not the case. Indonesia is more likely. India is more likely. Even the Americas have older cultures than there are in Egypt. Pardon me, Zahi Hawass, I beg your forgiveness. We have bones worldwide from Michael. Oh, what's Michael's name in his Forbidden Archaeology? Michael Cramo. We have civilizations that come from all over the world from various epochs of time. Egypt is maybe a likely point because of the Nile River feeding the world with its breadbasket up in the Upper Nile, but the reality is that most of the commodities used in the world, namely spices, gold, jewels, silver, etc., came out of Indonesia and India. They didn't come from up the Nile. The world depended upon the trade with the Far East. That's why Christopher Columbus came looking for the India or Indians. He came looking for a source of these commodities.
Let's go Rich, wildcard line for Glenn Kimball. Rich?
Hi, Rich? Ian. How you doing? Mr. Kimball, it's great to talk to you.
Thank you.
My question is, you were talking about a people that had the Cobram, and they finally decided to let you translate it. And I was wondering, who are these people, if you don't mind? And,
yeah. I'm glad you brought that up again. The Cobram, K-O-L-I-B-R-I-N, Bible?
K-O-L-B-R-I-N. I have not been given permission to speak of their contact information. They're very private people. I wish that were the case. You can go on the net and find them.
Okay, but these are people who have an original Gaelic copy, original English copy?
They have the original, a copy of original documents, yes. They were in manuscript form from the burning of the Glastonbury Abbey in 1184 AD.
Rich, you had a follow-up?
Please. Yes, I was wondering, why did Longshanks want to destroy this?
Because, for several reasons. First of all, Longshanks was very connected to Roman Catholicism in his day, and that would have been in direct conflict. Even the story of the creation itself out of the Cobram is very expanded from the story of the creation in the Bible, though in my opinion it doesn't conflict at all. And second of all, it probably gave power to the people who were... When Joseph of Arimathea went to Great Britain, he was given 12 hides of Glastonbury, or about 2,000 acres of ground. This was an autonomous country, didn't pay taxes, wasn't subject to the British crown for over 1,000 years. Longshanks wanted to own this country. He wanted to dominate this country. He wanted to take it under his protectorship. He didn't want... this country, this 12 hides of Glastonbury to be a sovereign nation anymore. He wanted to be ahead of it, and this Cobram likely gave them the right to be a sovereign nation.
Well, you know, they always say, if you want to control a people, control their story.
Right.
So that would be one way of subjecting them to his rule.
Exactly.
All right, let's get Mike on West of the Rockies for Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. Mike?
Yeah, hi, how are you guys doing? I'm trucking across you, Thomas, guys on XM.
Great. Glad to have you.
Thank you. Very interesting. Glenn, I have two questions for you. First one, is it possible that this buried treasure in Illinois could be confiscated, not be plundered from World War II? And the second question is if these temples and pyramids and other artifacts that are Egyptian or Hebrew in origin, would they prove that the Book of Mormon were true? I'll take my answer off here. Thank you.
Good question. Would that prove the Book of Mormon is true? And the first question is, could it possibly be a treasure from World War II buried in those caverns in southern Illinois? Glenn?
Well, I'm not even going to treat the issue of whether it proves the Book of Mormon is true or not. That's a matter of personal belief. That's not something for this program. In my opinion, I'm sorry, Ian, that's something for personal belief. But in terms of being a treasure from World War II, absolutely not. The dating of the artifacts, the antiquity of the runestones, could not have possibly have been from the epoch of Hitler. These things predated Hitler by thousands of years.
By the way,
one other comment is that they remember Monk's Mound was called Monk's Mound because of the Irish monks who lived there in the 5th century. They were writing letters back to the Vatican in their day. This is almost 1,000 years before, more than 1,000 years before Christopher Columbus came to the Americas, and those letters survive. They survive in museums in Iceland, or Reykjavik, Iceland, in our day.
Interestingly enough, though, to go back to that other thought, I just want to make sure I understand it. It couldn't be that those items that were hidden had been taken perhaps by American soldiers, and they were looking for a place to hide them until, you know, a number of years passed after World War II. You don't think that that could account for the these treasures?
The fact that there are runestones that depict who brought these treasures to this particular site say nothing about the World War II. They talk about the Moray sailors from the first century who brought them up the Mississippi.
That's just fine. I just thought I'd make sure I clarified the question in order to get a clearer answer for the caller. And thank you, everybody, so far who's been able to get through. The lines are still ringing. We'll get as many as we can in our remaining half hour for Glenn Kimball. You can find out more about him at ancientmanuscripts.com or by listening to Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. Well, we already have many callers, but we'll probably have time for one or two more than who we have already on hold. So if you're trying to get through, we'll do our best to get everybody in before the end of the hour with our guest, Glenn Kimball. And you can find out more about Glenn online, linking up to us at coasttocoastam.com. Also, a reminder, too, that all of these discussions go on all the time in the After Dark newsletter. 1-888-727-5505 if you want to get signed up for that. So let's run down. We'll start with the wildcard line. Brad has been hanging on for Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. Brad?
How you doing, Ian?
Good. You're talking with Glenn.
Yes. Okay. Glenn, I wanted to ask you if you're familiar with the principle of uniformitarianism in geology, saying that geologic processes, you know, happen the same today as they always have in the past. I'm familiar with that.
Uniformitarianism, I like that.
Well, that's what it's called. It's something in the 1800s. But anyway, it relates to your subject because I believe Pangaea, the supercontinent.
Right.
I believe that was Atlantis. And somehow it was split up, and that's why we can't find any remnants of it.
Huh.
Well, I just wanted to see if what he thought of that, and I'll let you go.
Thank you. That's interesting. Thank you, Brian.
Well, I'm going to give you a toll-free number at the end of the program about where you can find out some more about that. But I really don't think so. I don't think that Atlantis was busted up at all. I think when Krakatoa blew its lid in 11,600 years ago, that it melted the polar ice caps, at least caused a tsunami. These were very shallow islands. Seven of them survived, which the seven islands of the blessed, which became associated with the Pleiades, the Pleiades, which the Greek named the Pleiades. These civilizations from Atlantis, they knew about the Pleiades. They knew about the dark stars and the Pleiades. The Mayans used the Pleiades. The Toltecs used the Pleiades in estimating their calendar systems. And the Pleiades obviously go back to the seven islands of the blessed in the Atlantean period of time. So
in terms of any particular movement in terms of uniformitarianism. Again, I try and stay away from talking about promoting a particular group of people or their ideology.
Well, I like that word. I've never heard that before, so I'm always glad to be introduced to something like that. Thank you, Brad. Let's go for Ken on the wild card line, as long as we're there on Coast to Coast AM, for Glenn Kimball. Ken?
Hello, Ian. How are you?
Doing terrific. What do you think about all this?
Well, Mr. Kimball, I was listening here, and I was just reading this text. One of the previous callers had mentioned whether you thought this would prove the Book of Mormon and things in it and so forth, but I didn't hear any of that. I was just had been reading this, and it seemed to, you know, jump out at me that, you know, this author in the 1830s supposedly transcribed this book from golden plates left by these people that came out of Jerusalem and Egypt. It tells about one of the groups becoming cannibals and all these different things, and I just thought it was rather interesting. I don't know how many people have even heard of the Book of Mormon. I've heard different people say they were weird, and there's never been any kind of proof of it, but I just, you know, thought I'd throw that out there. I know he also lived in Illinois. The people in Illinois murdered him, and they
sure.
That followed him, you know, were run out of there. But I just thought it was rather interesting in how many people, you know, might look into that, not necessarily to call and promote the Mormons.
Sure.
I just heard this and thought I'd throw that in.
Well, thank you, Ken. Interesting part of the conversation. We'll go to Fred of the wild card line, too, for Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. Fred?
Yes, I'm enjoying your show tonight.
Thank you.
I just wanted to ask Mr. Kimball if there might be a connection in his mind or whether he's thought about the giants mentioned in the sixth chapter of Genesis in the Bible, and who saw the daughters of men and took them.
Sure.
On his wives, and then the Noah's flood shortly after. Then we read of Goliath, the giant, and his family with the six fingers and toes. And I'm trying to not ask a lot of questions because I know there's only so much in so much time. But
yeah, well,
then in my mind, I'm going to what he's saying about the Yucatan Peninsula giants and the prominence of the Brujas, the witchcraft in Mexico. What might be a connection in his mind with all this?
Well, I thank you that, Fred, we did talk a little bit about Genesis 6 earlier, so let's go ahead and jump to the Yucatan, Glenn. We were talking earlier about sightings of boys that were 9.5 feet tall. And it kind of makes you wonder, A, you know, how have they avoided detection so far? And B, how do they begin to come up with enough food for those guys? I know what my teenager's like at 13, and he ain't nowhere near that tall.
Well, obviously the biblical accounts of the giants is exactly who I'm talking about. That's dead on. As the Celts had giants in Great Britain. Obviously there were giants in Asia. There were giants in Egypt, there were giants in India, there were giants in China, and there were most specifically giants in the Americas, recorded in the diaries of Americo Vespucci, Magellan, Vasco da Gama, and many others who actually witnessed them, and I've seen them. So yeah, how do people avoid detection? Well, that question is based on the premise that we should know everything in the world in our day. Because we're Americans, and we have newspapers, and we have colleges. I'm going to tell you right now that we know less about, we know less than 1% of what there is to know in America. We don't know the majority of it. We know less than 1% of our own history in the Americas. Pardon me, but we're as ignorant as stones. In 200 years from now, we will look back at the onslaught of the technology of the Industrial Revolution as being the dark ages of the Industrial Revolution. We will look back at our universities and wonder why in the world professors protected us from obvious documents, knowledge, etc. Great Britain's false victim of this themselves. They know less about their history than we know about them. They know more about our history than we know about ourselves. I don't know what it is that we know more about people across the ocean and vice versa, but it tends to be the case. We don't look in our own backyard.
Well, let's go first-time caller line for Jacob and then get a break in and come back and get everybody else who's waiting. We'll run the table on the way. Jacob, you're on with Glenn Kimball.
Yes, Mr. Kimball, I just had a question for you. First off, I wanted to say I've really enjoyed hearing you gentlemen to discuss these wonderful topics.
Thank you.
And my question was, some time ago I'd heard an account of some natives or tribes people in South America who supposedly spoke Hebrew or Semitic language and practiced Judaism. And I just want to know, what are some of the main reasons why we see these instances of culture and religion in regions of the world that they're not normally associated with?
It happens all around the world, but you're absolutely right. You know, I was in La Paz when in Santa Cruz, Bolivia, the Catholic monastery was destroyed by a tribe of very tall, white, red-headed Amazonian Indians. They were slaughtered by them, a whole tribe of white Indians. These guys, I took a picture of one of them, one of their women, and she had big, high Indian cheekbones, but she looked like she was from Dublin, if you were to ask me.
That's an interesting connection, though, too, isn't there, between the Iberian Peninsula of, you know, of Spain and the Celts? The belief is that that many of the Spanish settled that part of the Emerald Isles, and that in that area. In fact, that's why we have the word Hibernian, you know, frequently associated with that, and that might explain why you've got those people also in Latin America.
Without any doubt, and if you go to the Stoke Dry Cathedral in Great Britain to this very day, it has a mural, a fresco on the side of the cathedral there, of the death of King Arthur II in the 6th century. The fresco's from the 7th century. But the pictures of King Arthur II in the 6th century, who died mortal wounds by Native American Indians.
Hmm.
Now, how in the world did that happen 1,000 years before Christopher Columbus?
Hmm.
He was obviously coming to the Americas looking for gold. He thought of the Americas as being his island of Babylon. And, you know, we could go on and on and on, the connections between the British and the Iberian peninsulas and the Celts and the Americas. It's just enormous.
Well, and to answer that question, though, that thought about pockets of Judaism that exist in the Americas, and how could that have happened? At least one explanation could also come from the period of the Inquisition, in which Jews that were practicing secretly maintained a public Catholic face, and yet still passed along the traditions, sometimes in very subtle ways, to their generations, and that it's possible that a group could have come over, formed a kind of, a community, a kind of maybe a commune of sorts, where they all, and then began to practice the traditions that they hadn't been allowed to practice in Europe. But I'd love to hear more about what people know about that, too.
Interestingly enough, I think you're probably right. But remember, even Vindel Jones in his backyard in Texas has Hebrew petroglyphs on the side of some of his archaeological sites. We have Hebrew petroglyphs here in Arizona. There are Hebrew petroglyphs in South America. There are writings all over the Americas in this hemisphere that were written in pure Hebrew. And like I said, the language of the Illinois caves is in a kind of a pidgin Greek Hebrew alphabet.
Well, that is fascinating, and I forget about that. You're exactly right. Well, then we'll get everybody else that we can coming up next for Glenn Kimball. Hang on. If you're on hold, you'll be one of the lucky next on a Coast to Coast AM. My name's Ian Punnett. We'll start west of the Rockies with Nancy in our remaining minutes for Glenn Kimball on Coast to Coast AM. Nancy?
Hey, how are you guys?
Good. You're talking with Glenn.
I am so enjoying this program, and I I am just on the edge of my seat, and I am such. I am a history buff. I went on a Celtic tour in Scotland in 1980. I'm just fascinated, riveted.
Had you ever heard of that discussion of King Arthur II killed by Native Americans?
No, but I.
Isn't that interesting?
Yes, all of it is interesting. I'm going to go to the website and really study. I was thinking you made a connection with the turbans on Native Americans. There's a picture of Chief Sequoia, the one that developed the Cherokee language. And he, in the picture, is wearing, he looks Indian. I mean, from India, he has a turban on and a shirt. And I was just thinking that some of the East Coast, and you know, out here in Arizona, the Pueblo Indians look a lot different from the East Coast Indians to me. I was thinking that there might be different places of origin for, you know, different types of Indians. But the,
sure. Well, let's get Glenn, stay with us, Nancy, and let's get Glenn's comment so far. Go ahead, Glenn.
Okay.
Well, like I said earlier in the program, many of the Native American Indians were not loincloth savages that we think they are. These people wore turbans. These people wore shirts. They wore pants. They were obviously from Asia, from the Middle East. The Celts didn't wear turbans. The Africans the Islamic people wore turbans in our day, but back in the day of the Moorish sailors, they wore kind of a peaked hat, a soft leather hat. The turbans were really Middle Eastern.
It strikes me, and I don't know how either of you feel about this, but one of those things that we can always use as a guide to who has been influential in an area is seeing how food has changed. You know how, you know, the Vietnamese food is always different from Chinese because it has that strong French influence from all those years of French occupation of Vietnam. So I'm just curious, Glenn, Nancy, either of you, do you wonder what how the food it was from these people and where did it come from? What did it get influenced by? And what do we know about it, Glenn?
Well, food is largely depending upon who's growing it in the region of the types of plants that grow it. But certainly the spices are probably more an interesting topic.
Right. I mean, do we see saffron or other things curry, other things we associate with Asian Indian cuisine in any of the Native American dishes? Or
The spices that came to the Native American Indians, many of them came from the Indies. And that's what I'm saying is that the mother of civilization, where people went to get not only gold and silver and precious jewels, but spices came from Indonesia and India. That's what Christopher Columbus considered the spice trade just as important as the gold trade.
Sure. Brian is east of the Rockies on Coast to Coast AM. Brian, you're talking with Glenn Kimball.
Yes, Ian?
Yes.
Yes, I was hoping Glenn could elaborate a little bit about the notion that the Appalachian people are of Portuguese descent.
Glenn?
It very easily could have been. The Portugal, as you well know, is borders right on the ocean. These were seafaring people, too, who had very close ties to all kinds of ocean people that sailed the world, not only the tribe of Dan who sailed the oceans, but other people. I wouldn't doubt at all that the Appalachian people have very distinct, in fact, my sister and her husband were the second in command in the embassy in Portugal up until about 2 years ago. And they tell me all the time about the connections between the ancient Americans and the Portuguese. And so you're probably very correct. I haven't done some specific research on that, but I will tell you one thing. The country of Brazil, the name Brazil itself means red man, which I think is kind of interesting.
Is it really?
Yeah. Brazil, the name means red man, and it came from the east through Portugal up the Straits of Gibraltar, that direction, not from the west.
Let's go to Peter on the international line. He may be our last caller on Coast to Coast AM for Glenn Kimball. Peter?
I just wanted to get some clarification from Glenn on the idea of fallen angels and how near-death experiences relate to that for individuals who are walking amongst us.
Oh, that's very interesting. The Nephilim and near-death experiences, Glenn, where do you go with that?
Man, we could do a whole show and have done a whole show on this one before. Certainly the first epic of men under Kronos, the king, these people were said to have never died and still walks amongst us as our guardian angels. In other words, they're not dead, and they are people who were mortal beings who had a lifespan beyond what we have, and they were holy people. They were righteous people. They were good people. And many people talk about having met somebody in the desert who appears suddenly, helps them fix a flat tire, and then they turn around and they're gone. These people you can touch, you can shake their hands, you can eat dinner with them, and suddenly they're missing. I've had that experience myself. In fact, when I was writing my first book, one of them came into my place of establishment through a locked door, sat down and said, you're about to throw your book in the garbage, don't do it because it'll influence many people. How did he know that I was about to chuck my book in the trash, thinking this is going to cause me all kinds of problems with my friends and family?
Well, very interesting. I think you're right in that it doesn't necessarily clarify it, but it just makes it a more tantalizing subject for the future. Well, Glenn, it's always a pleasure. We talked about giants, extra small people, otherwise known as my ancestors. We talked about ancient Americans, lost manuscripts, ancient mariners, and somewhere in the middle of all of that, talking trees, too. So it's always a pleasure to talk with Glenn Kimball.
Can we give the toll-free number?
Got to be quick. Go ahead.
That toll-free number for you who would like to call and either talk
quick,
about...
Quick, Glenn.
888-904-9394.
And link up to him, too, through coasttocoastam.com. Deus te amat, Glenn, and we do, too.